This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
First, they decided who would be making the cut. Then they made those cuts. But now, JT and Aaron are talking everything from wrestling to pop culture and beyond. Because it's no holds barred. Put your backs to the wall. What will your answer be? Will you run for the door? Will you run out on me like it's hard? It's no holds barred.
Hi, Place to Be Nation. This is JT coming at you live here for No Holds Barred, the podcast, episode number 2. And joining me on this journey is Aaron George. Aaron, how are you?
I live in a city where it was hotter today than in Miami. And 6 months ago, it was colder than the North Pole. And I can't, you don't understand how to live. There's no rhyme or reason. It's like living on Mars. Like it's the worst. And the culture here is not good enough to justify this. It's not good enough. We have a mountain and a cross, and it used to be fine, but now it's not okay anymore.
You could move.
Where am I gonna move?
San Diego is supposed to have nice weather.
Yeah, but anybody there? I don't feel. I feel I've heard the Booyaka song too much now. Like it'd be in my head whenever I had to give my phone number. It would just be the worst, and I don't want that. I don't want that for me, and I don't want that for my kids.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. I'd say you can move here, but I think we're like mini Montreal with the weather. So it was in the hundreds in the heat index this past week. So I burnt myself to a crisp yesterday at the beach, so there you go.
I burnt my hand on my steering wheel.
Mm.
I have a mark on my hand from my steering wheel.
Is it the Canadiens logo?
Yes, it is. It is.
It's like your stigmata. It is. Burns in.
That's what we all have here. But for anybody who's operating the illusion that it's 6 months of snow here, you got to get a clue. All right, it's right. Disgusting.
Yeah, it's gross. It is gross. The thing too with being burnt, like I'm red now, and I don't know if it's because of the sun or the stress, but my gray hair is coming out even more now, and I'm blaming kind of the sun because I feel like it really came out like yesterday. I feel like, and the red of my face is like offset, making it even kind of pop even more, and so I feel like Shane McMahon at this point. Look at the fucking half gray, half black nonsense he had like a decade ago. That's where I'm at right now. Like 2009 Shane.
I do love how you've blamed it on the sun and stress as opposed to
age.
The fact that you've caught the old.
Yeah, I am old. But I feel young at heart.
Yeah, that's going to go away soon too. Because everything in life is just going to hammer you.
Yeah, it's hammered me quite a bit, so I've survived, and I hope to continue to survive. All right, so this is our podcast, Aaron. What a great start. Hopefully no one's committed suicide yet. Yes. We're supposed to be jovial. That's what we're known for, late-night jovial recordings that make people giggle.
It's made me feel better to talk about it. I mean, I'm not any cooler, but I feel better.
Just upbeat. Alanis Morissette. So we're supposed to start with a pre-match promo is what we entitle it because we do a three-fall gimmick here. And that's our no-holds-barred moment of the day. Do you have anything today for us?
I do. Hmm. I do. And I want to preface this by saying that, like, I'm not lying about any of these things. Like, I know some of them might seem odd. I know the one I dropped last time will probably seem odd, but these are things that happen and – so today, I mean, already, I'm on edge. Mm-hmm. I'm on edge normally. Normally, I'm on edge.
Right. You now, live on the edge.
I'm on the edge. We're living on the edge. That is a great song. I wasn't in the – yeah, wrong decade. So I'm driving today, burning my hands on the steering wheel, of course, and I'm going down a residential area, right? So I don't know about you, but I'm already charged up when people are driving fast in residential areas. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about that?
Go on. No, yeah, it depends. I mean, I consider myself as a aggressive, aware driver. So I don't consider myself a fast driver. Now, I do drive fast, but not in certain areas. So, yeah, I'm with you.
Yeah, so, like, I'm always almost in the Dennis Reynolds school of, like, children play here, you fat cow, no matter how,
right,
no matter where I am. So, driving down this residential area, and this guy is, I'm going 30 kilometers, which I guess is, I don't know about, who knows? Yeah, you're all fucked up down there. So I'm driving about 30 kilometers, which is normal in a school zone, all right? And this guy behind me is just honking, like, just going crazy. And I mean, I could go faster, but now I'm not going to.
Right.
And the heat, everything, I'm charged up, right?
Like, mm-hmm. The heat is on.
And that's the sound that his car made as it fucking sped around me and cut me off. And then as he got in front of me, he started waving at me and, like, saying goodbye. Like, it was really obnoxious and weird. Right.
He flipped you off and had the Canadiens logo on his finger.
On his hand.
Yeah.
Yeah. He had the Bruins logo, which was especially upsetting.
So, like, Scott.
He was Scott Criscolo. He's on his way. You know what I found?
It's Captain Crunch himself.
Captain Crunch, yeah.
Couldn't keep it in.
Begins here.
Yeah.
I got to get in touch with him because I found a local chapter of the Knights of Columbus near my house.
Oh, so. Did you?
yeah, I did. I almost took a picture of it, but then I was like, just people playing volleyball in the back. So it looked fun. So this guy fucking blasts past me, and normally I let it go. I was going to let it go. Part of me said, you know what? I always let this go. What if I just kind of saw this through? Right? And so I'm like, you know what? If he's going the same way I'm going, I'll see it through. So I end up following this guy for about 6 minutes, mm-hmm. right? Now,
and what's that entirely in metric?
It's about 1,000 minutes.
Okay, yeah, gotcha.
1,000 goof shots. <Yeah. laughs> So I follow this guy because he's going the same way. And then, of all things, he pulls up at his house.
Oh, boy.
Right? Yeah, so I slide up to his house. And I don't know, like, I kind of look out the window. And I'm still contemplating what I'm going to do. Am I going to say anything? Right. Am I not? And he does this thing where he kind of jets his chin out, like, you know, like that, like, sharp chin jet, and goes, what? And so I don't know why I said this, but I said, okay, so you live at 1222, the street was, 1222, good to know. Now I know where it is. at which point he goes, what are you, a nutcase?
Yes.
To which I reply, I guess you don't know, right? I guess you don't know, but now 1-2-2. Right? And he was on his staircase, and he got really upset, obviously. And he began to charge down his staircase. But the best part was he had a lanyard in his pocket, and his lanyard got caught in his railing. So it didn't trip him up, but it delayed him. Like, he had to stop and go up and unlatch it, which was perfect. And then he came down to the car, and I didn't drive off. I kind of just stood there, and he's like, I am taking this license plate number. And then I just said, well, I've taken your address, and I drove off.
So what about the mustard, though? Did it spill?
This time it did. My car was fun. And plus it's hot, so it's, like, caked onto the dashboard now.
Gross, yeah.
Yeah, it's so disgusting.
I got to start going first. I think I went first last time. I should continue that tradition because I'm probably not going to top this madness that you have going on up in Canada.
And I want you to know that I didn't even, because we kind of decided almost last minute we're doing this tonight kind of thing, right?
So, right.
Like, I didn't do it in plan. It was just, let's see what happens.
Yeah. I didn't have much of a no holds barred day. My day was pretty calm. I think the most no holds barred thing I did was, as I mentioned, I don't know if I mentioned it here, but I mentioned it before, I'm doing the intermittent fasting stuff. So when my clock ran out today, I said, you know what, let's go out for breakfast. Because I haven't done breakfast in like a month and a half, I don't think, because I just never eat before noon. But I ate dinner, ended early last night, so I was ready to go. And I just destroyed this mountainous man version of breakfast. Just like, two giant pancakes, eggs, home fries, bacon, like just the whole thing. And I just took it all down, like the whole fucking thing.
What was the cost of the breakfast
on the
menu?
I want to say that the like combo was $8.99 or $8.50, and then like the bacon was, I don't know. I got a side of bacon. It didn't come with it because I wanted it.
It feels high for a breakfast, which means there's a lot of fucking food.
It was a lot. It's a little bit high. It is definitely a little bit high at that place. Like for all four of us, and we all got something. I want to say it was like $30-something.
Is that good?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's probably a touch high. Like, it's a touch higher than, like, if you go to, like, just a fucking diner. You know what I mean? Like, you probably just get. So it's, like, an in-between level. It's not, like, a chain where it'd probably be higher, but it's not a dive diner where it'd be, like, $3. So I think it's, like, in the middle.
I actually go to the States a lot. Like, we go to Burlington, Vermont a lot, and Plattsburgh, New York a lot, because we love America. And I search for wrestling figures. But, I always find that I just get crushed at these restaurants.
Yeah.
Like, they're just so goddamn expensive. And then the exchange rate kills me. But, like, even then, I don't leave there without paying $60 U.S.
Right. Yeah, if we go to dinner for the four of us, I would say it's generally, in you know, with tip is around $55 to $60.
Wait, you guys tip?
Just the tip.
Just the tip.
If we do this in a couple days.
Get a better job.
If we do this in a couple of days, I'd have a good no holds bar stories. I'm making my first official pulled pork butt on the smoker. So I think it's like a man thing. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, that's a man thing.
Yeah. So anyway.
I don't really do a man thing, so they're just probably going to be nonsense.
Yeah, I like the nonsense, though. It offsets my manliness.
Right.
Just a fucking
wild
man.
Card.
Like William.
I'm the wild card.
Yeah. Yes, you are. All right, that's enough. Why don't we get into our first fall, which is wrestling-based tonight. And just like last episode where we dug into the GWE Tag Team Project, we're going to do that again. Only we're not going to give another overview for the 100th time. And this time we're actually going to start discussing some teams. And before I do that, I want to direct you over to Tyler Kelly's piece that dropped today, PlaceNation.com, as he continues his cheat sheet looking at some teams as well. So that content is starting to leak out. As the project, you know, I think we're right around target as last year as far as starting to get some content out. So look for more. But we're going to discuss three teams here tonight, Aaron. It's going to be two real teams. And then I think, you know, we talked about this last episode, how this project lends itself to short-term teams as well. Maybe only a match or two in the catalog. And so we have one of those that we're going to discuss. We'll save that for last. Because we feel like we don't want to ignore. We don't want to just do the big teams. We want to touch on some of these fringe cases that could sneak in the bottom half. Because, again, it's such a... 100 teams is a lot. It's a lot of slots. So why don't we start in the mid-90s, though? Our first team we're going to discuss is Billy and Bart, the cousins turned brothers. And that is the Smoking Guns. What are your initial...
Turned lovers.
Possibly. What are your initial thoughts on the Guns?
I mean, my gut reaction is I hate anybody who wrestles in jeans.
Yeah, it looks really uncomfortable. Like the chafing, I would think.
You know who had a hard time was Davey Boy Smith. Like,
oh, yeah.
That poor guy pulled those jeans up after every single move.
I don't know why they forced them to wrestle in the jeans and those big boots.
No. What are you doing? But then again, these guys wrestled in cowboy boots. Look, initially, at the time, I didn't like them.
But they were soft cowboy boots. They weren't like the hard cowboy boots.
Yeah,
You know, like a woman would wear, like a dressy boot.
Like they're also the soft cowboys. Like correct. They'd be getting raped by the more manly cowboys. Let's face reality here. Yeah.
Or
like,
or their wives. There's no way their wives would easily get stolen by like Stan Hansen at the saloon.
Their wives must have just told them what to do all the time.
Oh yeah, they're whipped.
Why do you think
they had those mustaches and then had to shave them? Like that mustache, you're getting a little too. A little too strong there, Bart. Take that mustache off.
Yeah, okay. No wonder they were so happy when Sunny showed up.
I know, right?
Like, oh, God, a young woman.
But even she made
but looking
her,
back,
her bitch, you know?
Pardon me?
She made them her bitch, too, so.
Yeah. I guess they were bitches. They were just bitch.
They were bitches.
The bitch brothers.
Yeah.
Yeah. But looking back, they're the anchor of that entire division for like a good 4 years.
See,
so
I disagree.
They're really,
that.
Really.
Yeah. And you know what? Chad and I have explored this topic a bit on the Wrestling War Zone. It all comes together. Cheap plug. I've watched the Raws from 93 through late 95 now, Aaron. And it's really not until early 95 when they become the anchor team around the division. For much of 93 and 94, they don't do a lot. Like, they're not really. You know, they're not on TV a ton. They're not on pay-per-view a ton. They don't really have any feuds to speak of at all during that time frame. It isn't until January, when they become tag team champions, when they defeat Bob Holly and the 1-2-3 Kid, that the division really starts to become built around them. And all through 95, they're kind of the main face team, but even for a stretch there, they're not featured a ton because Owen Hart and Yokozuna have the belts. I just think their spotlight time is actually a lot less than it seems in theory because the division is so weak through a lot of that time that you just remember them. But I think their real run of relevance is January 95 until they split in like the fall of 96.
See, look, I think you're probably right there. You're probably right. You're about 70% right. I would also say that what helps their case is that they're one of the few consistent teams that sticks around for that whole era.
Sure.
Whereas
maybe they
aren't necessarily the focus in 93, 94. They are a team that does get play, and that I think that does help their case when they get to 95, 96, mm-hmm. that they've been around forever and you can build around them then.
Sure. Yeah, no, I agree. When they first came in 93, it seemed like they were more primed for something bigger. Like, their program right away, pretty much in the mix with Money, Inc. But, you know, then you get the Steiners kind of hanging around. And then I don't think they expected the Quebecers to take over the division the way they did. I don't know if they anticipated what would happen. Like, because the Steiners win the belt and almost immediately lose it to the Quebecers. Like, it's like a month later. And then that's it for the Steiners. And the Quebecers are almost like main event level team for a bit. Like, they're in there with, you know, friendly with Yoko and Borga and kind of feuding with Luger here and there. And then they do all the stuff with Jannetty and the Kid, you know, like they're kind of like a higher upper, you know, like a half a level above the rest of the division.
Yeah. Just don't say Jannetty and the Kid in the same breath as like Luger and Yoko. Cause it's completely ridiculous.
Well, yeah, but like singles guys, is I guess what I'm trying to say. Right. So they're,
right.
They're not just like the tag division is very defined in 92 and 93. But the Quebecers just seem to But the Quebecers, like Money Inc., I guess, early in the year, right, is kind of there, like the feud with the Megamaniacs. And the Quebecers kind of felt like the spiritual successors to that. Like, they're not just a tag team. They're kind of, they can play up and down the card a little bit. But anyway, my point is, so the Guns kind of get ignored there because the Steiners win it and the Quebecers win it and they kind of just dominate through the whole winter. And then you think, okay, well, maybe the Guns now, but the Men on a Mission get the title shot at Mania, and they quickly fade. And then the Head Shrinkers turn face, and then it kind of becomes their division until Sean and Diesel take the belts, and now, like, the division is completely nothing, right? So it's kind of like, it seemed like every time maybe they would be getting some kind of run, they just end up taking a back seat. And, like, they kind of have a half-assed feud with the Heavenly Bodies, a half-assed feud with Well Done, on like syndicated and house shows, but there's really nothing, you know, nothing special going on there. And then their first real bump is Survivor Series 94, where they were on Luger's team. And then from there is kind of where they start to rise. So, it felt like every time they were going to maybe start to get a push, they just weren't really the priority at that time.
Sure. Yeah. And you can make the argument that that was almost always the right choice.
Oh yeah. I would agree.
Like, maybe not with Men on a Mission, but, like, I mean, the Head Shrinkers certainly are, I would consider them a better team than the Guns. And, mm-hmm. Who is it? The Steiners, for sure.
Oh, yeah.
It's not even a question, right?
And the Steiners are already in position anyway. I mean, the Guns, they would have been behind the Steiners. But it's just that when the Steiners lost, I think the Quebecers just took off more than anyone expected and ended up holding the belts for a lot longer than people probably thought.
Yeah, well, I mean, they're not the Mounties, but they're good. I always thought, and now that I'm hearing it, it's really interesting that, like, as much as it's a promotion, WWF's a promotion that builds around a face champion for the most part, or at least used to be, they really did spend a good time amount of time building around heel tag teams.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's interesting. I don't know where to go from there with it, but...
Well, no, I think it's a good point, because I think a lot of times the world champion was a face. So their secondary champions would be heels to balance things out, right? So Hogan's on top, and they'd want the, you know, Honky Tonk and the Hart Foundation as the champs underneath, because they were going to try and balance the card out. They didn't want all faces or all heels. 93 is interesting because Yoko's champ for most of the year, And then most of the year also as the heel tag champ and heel IC champ and Shawn Michaels throughout most of it as well. So that's a very heel heavy year for them.
93, what a weird, strange year. I went to Disney World that year. It was lovely. Hmm. And also, my father and I discovered the Proclaimers song, I Would Walk 500 Miles.
Did you
How was your
1993? 500 miles? To,
my 93...
There you go. My 93 would have it was pretty good. It was late in the year. I would have started 8th grade, and that was a fun year for me. Graduated elementary school in 94. No, it wasn't bad. It was really the first year I had started watching wrestling in 90, but I think 93 was like the first year I was really into, or I really got to see like all the pay-per-views and stuff. Like WrestleMania 8 was the first pay-per-view I saw. I didn't see Rumble 92. But like 93, like I saw everything and, you know, was watching, you know, Raw started. So it was a big wrestling year for me in 93. A big sports year too. I think I started to become more cognizant really of following like baseball and football and stuff. So.
Right. 93 was the Blue Jays, right? They won that year.
Yeah. And like, that's one of the first, like I remember World Series before that, but 93 is like one of the first years I remember like even like regular season / playoffs, like leading up to the World Series.
Right. That was actually the last year the Canadians won the Cup, Stanley Cup, too.
It was. They beat the Kings.
Yeah. But they should have played the Leafs. The Leafs would have beaten them. But anyway, we digress. Smoking Guns. Smoking Guns.
See, look, we're even making them our bitches. We're not even talking about
right?
them.
Yeah. To talk about the Toronto Maple Leafs of all teams.
I saw the Guns pretty early on at a house show in May of 93. In Providence. I don't know if they had even been on TV yet, or they might have had a vignette. But I don't remember when they like first aired on TV or whatever. But I'm trying to find it here when it was. But I remember thinking they were like really cool. I remember actually thinking they were like the Rockers. Like that was our comparison because when we first saw them, I was like, oh, they're like kind of flying around. You know, I feel like Dirty F hadn't really had a team like that, like aerial guys, like I can't think of any, like since the Rockers, you know, throughout 92 and into 93. Yeah, so it was May 2nd, 93. They lost to the Head Shrinkers. Oof, only 3,000 people at the dunk on that matinee show. Tough one.
A matinee.
Yeah. We did see a Mr. Perfect Shawn Michaels 22-minute time limit draw, so there you go.
God, that must have been. I'm sure it was fine, but.
Right.
Like, was that the main event?
Well, no, here's the full card. So Brooklyn Brawler beat Jim Powers. Damian Demento beat El Matador. Headshrinkers beat the... Yeah, right? Rare. Headshrinkers beat the Smoking Guns. Yokozuna beat Jim Duggan. Bam and Bigelow beat Kamala. The draw with Michaels and Perfect. And then they actually did a... After the draw, Michaels had... Oh, I'm sorry, during the match, Michaels had pinned Perfect, hitting with the belt. Smoking Guns and Jim Powers rushed to the ring to tell the ref what happened. They continued the match. And then I think they did... Yeah, Perfect got the Perfect Plex at the bell. It was something like that where they actually did a pretty good twist finish, too, where we thought Perfect won the belt. He didn't, obviously. Bob Backlund beat Blake Beverly, and then Bret Hart beat Luger by DQ. Razor Ramon interfered, which he didn't wrestle, which was weird. So, anyway, that was the card. And then that they also had a show. They had two other shows that day, one in Binghamton, which had the other crew, and then Springfield pretty much had the same card that we got.
What business did Jim Powers have coming down to the ring to argue with anyone?
I guess he saw the Guns running out. Hey, well, not that far
up
on the other card. Yeah, I'm going to go with him.
Well, look, it's good to know that early in their career they stood up for justice because that's what I want out of my Cowboys.
That's right. That's right. They weren't quite the Rockers, though, as we'd find out. All right. What's the first Smoking Guns match that pops in your head?
It's the six-man tag from...
SummerSlam.
I guess it's SummerSlam 93, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
93, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's them and Tatanka, quite the odd pairing there, mm-hmm. versus Bam Bam and the Head Shrinkers, which would go on to produce... That pairing would go on to produce one of the worst matches ever at Survivor Series 93.
Yeah.
But I remember thinking that match, even rewatching it recently, was really fun. Like I liked the way that they moved around the ring. I thought they were different. You're right. I think that you got a Rockers vibe, but they were bigger guys. Mm-hmm. So there was something different there. Yeah, that's the one that stands out for me early. What about you?
Yeah, I'd say that in my memory had been the match with Holly and Kidd, But when Scott and I rewatched it, I wasn't as impressed. Like, it was still fine.
Yeah.
But it wasn't as good as I remember. I was going to try and pull it up quick and see what I had for a grade. But, yeah, so I'd say that one. And then I think just, like, the later stuff with in 96 when they start to go heel. Like, they have a couple of decent matches, like with Bulldog and Owen late in the year. But much of that year, they're kind of saddled with the Body Donnas, who are fine, and then the Godwins through the middle of the year. So, and then they start wrestling heel, and they kind of slowed things down. I don't know. They're an interesting case. Like, I feel like they don't really have that standout match.
No. And I think that 96 period is a really interesting period of time because for the first time in a while, it felt like they really cared and gave focus to the tag division.
Right.
But they just didn't have the teams that anybody actually cared about.
Right.
There was so much time given to the Guns, the Godwins, the New Rockers, the Body Donnas. Like, it's ridiculous.
But, yeah, no, they were trying. Yeah, they were trying. But, yeah, you're right. It's a rocky division at that point. So I went on that. I went 3 stars on the night after the Rumble when the Guns win the belts from the Kid and Holly. I went 3. And I feel like they fought a couple weeks later. I'm going to try and find it. Which I thought was not as good. Actually, it looks like it was the next week. So let me find what I had that one. And that one was kind of disappointing. So that may actually be their best tag match.
I have a 3-star match from the first In Your House with Owen Hart and Yokozuna.
Oh, yeah.
Rematch
from
WrestleMania.
Yep.
I quite like that one.
I went 1.5 on the Kid and Holly rematch.
Well,
yeah.
What a wonderful match for that.
Yeah, not a good match. I remember being real disappointed. After seeing the 3-star one.
As I go through, like, going through 96, like, I always found that, like, you know what maybe they're one of their better matches is? And I guess you'd have to rewatch it some of what you think, too, is their mind game match with
Bulldog
and Owen. Yeah. I had that 3.25.
Yeah, I like that one. I had the In Your House match at 2. And I'm going to see what I have for WrestleMania. Yeah, I feel like I had WrestleMania higher, actually.
See, I have WrestleMania 2.5, but let's just throw something out there because this might be important going forward. What does 2 mean for you?
Well, let me just say this WrestleMania grade, then we'll get there. So I had 2.5 for WrestleMania. So to me, 2.5 is like it's a good match. It wasn't boring. They didn't really do anything bad, but nothing really stood out. So a 2 to me is like an average, like perfectly acceptable wrestling match, right? The old Scott Keith term, right? So just a perfect, like, so that's almost like if an MSG house show match between two guys you wouldn't think it's 2, it's like, okay, well, you know, like Don Morocco and Dino Bravo go 2 stars. It's like, okay, like that's pretty good. You know, that's like, okay, they had a fine match.
Right.
It's like a fine match, 2 stars to me. So that was a fine tag. When I get to 3, I start thinking 3 is like, okay, this is like, we started to get to 3 and up is like almost rewatch territory. And like Chad and I, you know, we've been doing kind of quarters on Wrestling Warzone and hidden gem matches for us, 3 and a quarter and up are considered like a match that, you know, is worth checking out on these Raws and Nitros.
Right.
So 3 is like borderline that. So I had that at 2. So I thought that In Your House match was perfectly fine. And WrestleMania I thought was on the verge of being good.
See, mine, it's like everything you just said, but 0.5 star up.
Right.
So, for instance, like 3 is good and 2.5 is like, okay, but it's boring maybe at points. Mm-hmm. Or like for me, when it gets into like 2, it means like, I mean, for me, 2 is like a 40%, right?
Right,
like,
yeah.
Like, and to me, like I always have these questions about star ratings like that because like I see people rate squash matches sometimes at like 0.5 star.
Mm-hmm.
But then we'll rate like Undertaker Giant Gonzalez at like
2.75 stars.
Yeah. Oh yeah. You know what I mean? And you're it's me. Like, there's no way that like that squash is less enjoyable than that Taker Giant Gonzalez.
It
match.
Depends
you know,
what
like,
you're looking for. I guess it depends what you're looking for. Like to me, squashes can be like, so for me, I always did squashes at a dud. Like when Scott and I started doing these Raws, I did squashes at a dud. Him and I don't do quarter stars. So I did squashes at a dud unless it was like something like a Steiner squash was usually 0.5 star, right? Because they murder guys. So there's some level of enjoyment. Now, Chad, he has an interesting scale where he gives very few duds and very few 5 stars. Like you have to be like peak on, you know, or valley, right? All like full on. So he'll give a quarter or half to anything that he thinks is bad. He'll only go dud for the absolutely dreck of the dreck. And he doesn't consider squashes as like dreck. Like they're quick, there's value. So for him, it's like a dud is like a real zero value proposition. And then a five is like elite. And he doesn't give many fives. He doesn't give many duds. So that's where he's kind of settled in between. Which I can see. I can get it.
Yeah, for me, a squash is almost always 2.5.
Right.
Because for me, as soon as you get to 2.25, you're hurting the show.
Okay, so you're saying just a squash wouldn't even be like a – okay, so you're saying be 2.5.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Like it's like when you start to get to 3, you're helping the show. When you start to get to 2.25, you're hurting the show.
See, yeah, so like, but I get some variance in there.
Helping, it's not hurting.
See, I get some variance too because I put some variance in it too. Like, so those MSGs, like it's a slew of 1.5 to 2-star matches, but those, like I said, like in 1988 MSG with some of those guys, like a 2 is a good. Like, but I can't go any higher. So I do a lot of my ratings. Like, I don't know. Do you do in a vacuum or do you comparatively think of it? Like, if I'm going to give a match a 3, I think, okay, well, I give this other match a 3 and I think it's worse than that. So I'm going to take it down or I'll raise that up. Like, do you do that or do you have everything in a vacuum?
Yeah, I try to do that, but I think that it's all about the distances, right? Like, like for me, a squash is way, way, way closer to a 3 than it is to a dud.
Right.
Because a dud or 0 or whatever you want to call it is just garbage. Like it's the worst thing ever. Right. So to have it like, even at 1-star feels too close to it. Like if you were in school, I guess I don't know what it's like. A pass is 6. Like for me, like if you're veering around 0, like you're the absolute worst. And a squash just
right.
I don't know, like it is closer to a good match than that. And you're right, like I will also try to compare, like okay, well, I gave this, and but I think there's also some context. Things involved too.
Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, for sure. Like guns versus Owen and Yoko may clock the same to me as Morocco Bravo, right? But obviously, guns Owen Yoko is better than that was. But in its time frame, like a 2 in 88 is great, you know. But a 2 in 95 is not as good, and a 2 now, you know, is like if you're having 2-star match, you're really struggling now. Like, you know, the baseline today is like 3.5 probably.
Well, if there's 2, like for me, if it's a 2-star match, it means there's flaws. Like there's something wrong in the match. To give you like a global thing, like I'm watching pay-per-view year. So in a given pay-per-view year, like I might have 5%. Let's say 20 to 25%. From anywhere from 2.25 down and 4 up. And then everything, the rest of the 80 is in that, like, I would even say 3.75 up. So, like, the 80% of what I watch is, like, 2.5, 3, 3.25.
Right. So, it sounds like you start in the middle and then go up or down.
Yeah, like, you start at a baseline.
Okay.
And then I started dud,
and I just work up. So... But I mean, that's what I just, you know, I gave it to say, okay, this match just has to be this good to get to a 0.5-star. Okay, they did that. Now it's up to 1-star. Okay, they did that. Now it's up to 1.5-stars. You know, like, so that's how I look at it. Like, it just climbs its way up. So if it tops out at 2, like, I thought Owen Yoko Guns was kind of short. It didn't have the spectacle of Owen winning the gold of Mania that it had. You know, it was fine to get the point across. It's almost a squash in a way. There's not much to it. Nerve hold kind of slows it down. So it's like,
It's not that much. There's not that much. Because I would have docked it for nerve hold.
Okay.
So there might be some, but...
Well, I mean, the match is under 6 minutes. So, like, you know, that too, which is fine. I don't dock too much for you know, short if it's great. But anyway, I think this is a topic for another show. So are guns on your list?
Oh, yeah. I would venture to say, I could easily say probably top 50.
Yeah, I think that sounds about right. It may be even a little bit higher once you start to look at the lack of depth. I think they're a team that'll probably benefit from
being around forever.
Yeah, being around for a while and just the lack of overall like numbers. But they're also a team that it could be interesting to see how they survive against other teams that have a shorter resume but higher quality stuff. So I think that'll be the question.
Yeah, I'm gonna be rating the higher quality stuff higher.
Right. I think for this project I will more as well. So
yeah, and they're always good for me. They're always good for a good match, and I think they have some interesting variety because when they do go heel, I think especially Billy, mm-hmm. Billy changes quite a bit. So I think there's something interesting there too in terms of their versatility.
Like, how would you compare them to the Steiners?
Oh, the Steiner. Well, it's tricky because the Steiners are not around nearly as much.
Right, but I would say the Steiners also.
I don't think their run is actually that good, though, the Steiners. Like,
yeah, but see,
I love watching them.
I don't know. I feel like they go more than the Guns, though. When you look at, like, the Headshrinkers match at 9, and then this Money in Cage match, which is really good, and the Quebecers match on Raw, which is really good, plus all of the squashes, which to me add up. Like, their squashes all through 93 are tremendous, and they're pretty, you know, they're good in the Heavenly Bodies match and even the Survivor Series match. Like, I think their resume, when you look at their top stuff versus the Guns, there's more to it.
Yeah, like, to me, it feels like a no-brainer to put them higher.
Right.
But, like, it's going to depend on how much you personally weigh longevity, like, in terms of where they go. Because I don't think they don't have the highest of high stuff either.
No.
It's not like they have, like, I mean, like, an interesting comparison to the Steiners might be the Revival.
Right.
Because the Revival have a short run. They have some, I mean, they're never bad, but they have some times where they're not being booked, but their stuff is so high.
Yeah.
I'm going to keep coming back to the Revival.
Right. They're a richer man Steiner in Dirty F. Steiner. Right? I mean, their high is way higher than the Steiners, but the idea is there. I mean, the Steiners aren't even there a year, or just a year, I think. But no, it's an interesting case. To me, the longevity thing is only going to play in if it's if they excel at the longevity, right? So a long period of great stuff, to me, with the tag teams weighs more. Whereas with the singles, I kind of factored in longevity anyway. But for tag teams,
right.
If you're around for a while, it's good because tag teams just don't last as long. But I'm probably only really going to give big points to it if it's like excellent to longevity, like we've seen with the Usos or the Hart Foundation.
New Day,
yeah. Right? Where now we're talking 5-6 years, which is long for tag teams, and most of it has been great.
That's
the Hardys, right? So, I mean, that's where it really factors
in. Well, it's just then the metric is different, right? Like when we're talking GWE singles, like if someone's there 7 years, we're like, I don't know if he has enough.
Right.
Like if a tag team has 7 years, that's like Bruno holding the belt for 8 years.
Right. Like, yeah, exactly.
It's this absurd number, you know?
All right. So it's not like we're about the same boat. I think probably 40 to 50 with the Guns, but I think they are a team that could fall if people really start to not care about, you know, any kind of longevity, if they really start putting factor like a team like an Edge and a Rey Mysterio, or, you know, like a team that may have an all-time classic but not much else, like, you know, how does that start to come into play? So I think it depends how high people are comfortable ranking teams like that, I think will affect a team like the Guns, who have a solid resume, enough to get the top 100, but not enough to start, you know, if you don't care, if a team with two great matches is enough for you and nothing else, then Guns may really be hurt by that.
Well, and you'll also get the people who are the anti-Billy Gunn contingent.
Correct.
But I don't actually think the criticism is nearly as important for him in the tags. I think he's quite good in the tags for the most part.
Yeah, I mean, and he's been in a lot of good ones. Like, obviously, the New Age Outlaws are going to rank high. And even Billy and Shock was, like, fine, you know? Like, they were fine.
Yeah.
No, his tag stuff isn't the problem. It's the single stuff is where he's, you know, looked at as the goof.
Except when he was the one, because that was just awesome.
Of course, yes, with the great theme.
And look at all he's got.
He even had the great team with Big Show, Double Trouble, Shit on a Stick. So,
yeah. Did they ever go by Shogun?
Yeah, I don't know. I think they referred to that. I don't remember if they actually used it. I think they did. I feel like they did. Because that's when Vince said, yeah. I don't care what you call yourself, Double Trouble, Crap on a Stick.
And then he's hurt by the rockabilly nonsense also.
Yeah. All right, if we want to talk other tag teams, let's move on.
Yes.
So we want to do one other one that does have a long run, and I think will clock in quite high, and that's Edge and Christian, part of the 2000s rebirth of the tag division. I think a team at first, to me, when I was looking at them, I think we covered this too probably when we talked about Edge and Christian on the WWE list, but Like, I feel like they were kind of lagging early. I thought they were outshined by the Hardys, like, in the tit. And then the Dudleys come around, and them and the Hardys have the great tables match. And Edge and Christian feels like, okay, they don't have much of a character. They're not as high-flying as the Hardys. They don't brawl as well as the Dudleys. Like, it's kind of like, okay, where's their niche? And then they win the belt at WrestleMania, which I think, looking back, was kind of inspired. Because I think they were the least likely to win going into that match.
Yeah.
And but the Dudleys and Hardys didn't really need them. And I thought it was shrewd to give it to Edge and Christian, who really needed the belts to justify, you know, to help get them over and give them some cred. Whereas the Dudleys and Hardys had already kind of done that, right? So then, and the Dudleys had already been champs anyway. And then, actually, had the Hardys been champs too? They had like a real brief one, right? In 99, I think.
Yeah, they did, yeah. With Michael Hayes, yeah, right?
It was very brief. But anyway, it was before they broke out. And then, so Edge and Christian, they kind of needed the belts most out of those three teams. And then, boom, by Backlash, all of a sudden they figured out this personality of being snarky assholes. And that's when it clicks. And they, in a way, become kind of the lead dogs of the division, where they get chased for most of the time. And we've talked about the resume in the singles list, and I think it obviously counts even more here, because now those five-star matches, you know, count heavily toward, for them. The all three, yeah, of them, the tables match and then the two TLCs. Are they in the third TLC as well? No, they're not in that one, are they? Oh, yeah, they are, right?
Oh, no, not the third. The third was the one on Raw, right?
No, that's the fourth. They are in the third. The third is more Benoit and Jericho win on SmackDown.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and that's a great one, yeah, too. Yeah. No, they're not in four. Four is the Kane one, yeah, on Raw.
Wasn't that the greatest match in Raw history at Raw 10th anniversary?
It sure was.
That's way better than Austin and Michaels against the Bulldog and Owen.
Oh, yeah.
Way better. Way better than Foley winning the title.
So, Edge and Christian, what do they jump out for you as far as... because to me, they're a complete package, right? They got the matches, they got the characters, they got the memorable moments. They can work as heels, they worked as faces. You know, they were main event level. They kind of check all the boxes. Top 10?
I don't know if they'll hit my top 10. Because I think, for me, they're the lesser of the three those three big teams. Like, I think the Hardys are kind of head and shoulders above them, mm-hmm, and I think the Dudleys are maybe slightly above them.
Yeah, see, and I have them ahead of the Dudleys.
See, I like a lot of the Dudleys tag stuff. Excuse me. Because, I mean, look, the big ladder matches are all a wash, right? They're all a wash, mm-hmm, because they're all in it together. But I like the Dudley straight tag stuff a lot more than I like Edge and Christian straight tag stuff. I don't enjoy them as much as a cohesive team that I do, like, say, the Hardys and the Dudleys. Like, I find – I mean, they did some tag stuff together, but it – for me, watching them still felt like – it's going to sound weird, but it still felt a little like two singles guys, which was weird because they were so presented as a team.
Right.
It's not like so they didn't feel as cohesive as the other ones. And that's something I think for me that's going to play into this project a lot. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't think I'm not arguing that they should be off the list or anything crazy or but I think maybe for me it's probably safer top 15, top 20 because I put them behind those three. Right. And I know in a way the guys who transcended the division more. But I don't agree with you to the same level that they transcended. I know you've kind of made that argument with them before. And I think there is some truth to it. I just don't think it's anywhere near the level of, say, like the way a Demolition transcended the division.
See, it's a little bit different, though, because Demolition was in a time where the tag division was presented as almost equal to the singles, so they were the kings of it. Whereas in 2000, the tag division was not presented that way. And so the big difference to me is Edge and Christian were – again, able to elevate into that main event scene and have those matches with the big dogs and, you know, hang with Taker and Kane or be in a six-man with Kurt Angle against, you know, The Rock and whoever else.
Like, yeah, they just – for me, they felt like filler guys in those things. Not afterthoughts. That's not what I mean. But, like, when Hogan's teaming with Demolition, it's like, oh, these are three big guys. When I see Angle teaming with Edge and Christian, I think, okay, well, there's Angle, and then there's this kind of, like, for the lack of a better word, little buddies.
See, like, I saw Edge as a little buddy. I can see the argument for Christian, who kind of felt like Edge is a little – so, like, to me, it was like, all right, 1A, 2, you know, like Kurt, Edge, or Christian. But
even when they were still a team, you saw Edge as a 1A.
Yeah, as soon as they started with the shtick, because of his size and everything and look. If for some reason the long hair worked with him, but with Christian, it just made him look. I think it's just his body. Christian, to me, doesn't become legit till he cuts the hair in 03.
Right.
But no, I did.
To some of us, he never becomes legit.
Yeah, I know. No, I did see it in Edge. I did. It, pretty quickly after once they get the personalities by like mid-2000, Edge to me felt like the leader of that team and a guy that would eventually. He like immediately jumped out as like the Shawn of the team at that point.
See, I think there's a difference between seeing the potential in him versus how he was presented then. And I don't see, like, obviously, like, with the look and the hair, I could see how, yeah, okay, there's probably potential here. But the character he had at the time was not anywhere near a main event character. It was a comedy character, which is great, and I like comedy characters. But
so the Dudleys were main event level characters?
No, but I wouldn't argue. I would say Edge and Christian were probably presented as bigger stars than the Dudleys, but I like the Dudleys work more.
What are the big Dudleys matches?
The big ones are only the TLC ones, and there's a couple of tables and stuff like that.
Right. But and I'd say their best straight match is against Edge and Christian in Rumble 01.
I didn't like that one that much. Yeah. I preferred like their straight matches with the Hardys. I prefer their straight matches. Another one, just blanking on now. But I like their straight tag stuff better because I find them more cohesive. But just jumping back to the character thing for a minute, the reason why I didn't think they could be considered main eventers because they were comedy characters. But Kurt was kind of a comedy character too. But his in ring style, for me, was so light years ahead of what Edge was doing in terms of believability and legitimacy that like he could transcend that comedy. Very few could actually transcend that comedy role, which is why again I just had trouble with them. Like in the transcendent argument, I'm not saying they weren't treated better than their division at the time because that to me would not be a feasible argument. But in comparison to other teams that I think transcended, I don't think they're up there.
So you think there are 10 to 15 teams that transcended more than them?
No, I think there are 10. There's clear. No, because I'm not basing it entirely on that.
Okay.
Like I'm basing it a lot more on their work and a lot of other different things. Like I think there's 10 to 15 teams that I think are a better package as a tag team when you factor everything in. Now, maybe I'm going to make my list and be proven wrong. That's very possible. But yeah, I mean, they wouldn't sniff my top five. Like, wouldn't sniff it. Like,
yeah, no, I don't. I mean, I don't think I'd have them top five either. But I could see them, you know, in that 8 to 10 range versus, like, the 15 to 17 range, if that makes sense.
It's possible. I mean, like, again, it just depends what you factor in, right?
I have a heavy nostalgic tie to them too. I mean, I was like a big fan of them in 2000, them and Angle, and all that stuff. So I mean, some of my favorite stuff was them in that era. So I think that's going to play into.
And I might have the opposite bias mm-hmm. in that I never liked Edge. Like I didn't dislike him, but I never was in. Like I wasn't all in. Like for me to put them 8 to 10, they'd probably have to go ahead of a team like the Hart Foundation or the British Bulldogs. I don't know if that's going to happen.
Yeah.
Because those are the teams that are probably going to – that might sound crazy to some people, but those are the teams that are probably going to populate my 8 to 10.
Uh-huh. I don't think that's too crazy. So, although at first glance, I think I'd have Edge and Christian ahead of the Bulldogs, but
– maybe. But I don't know if I have them ahead of Owen and Bulldog.
Right.
I'd have to look. I really got to look. I don't know if I'd have them ahead of London and Kendrick, you know, which is probably another team in that range.
All right.
I don't know if I'd have them ahead of the Bar. Like a Bar is a team Tyler talked about today, actually. Mm-hmm. But that's another team that I don't know if I'd have them ahead of that team. So that's what it is, like, for me. Like, it's not – I'm not trying to shit on them. Like, obviously, like, for me, a top 20 thing is great. But that we're a little bit off. That's all.
Okay. All right, let's do one more quick hit, and that's the Mega Powers. So what do they actually have for tag? I mean, they got SummerSlam 88, and then I guess, you know, depends how you want to
– Huh? They got Survivor Series.
Right, but so do we count that? I mean, were they technically the Mega Powers, or was that Hogan and Savage at the match?
Well, look, I have a major – I'm going to bring up a major problem right away, and this doesn't get talked about nearly enough, right? But Savage shows up for Survivor Series in the Mega Powers tights.
Right.
Hogan doesn't wear the goddamn Mega Powers tights.
Yeah.
What kind of
– So I'm not counting that. I don't think I'm counting that match in the Mega Powers catalog. Tights. I think they're separate. I think they're in there as singles guys, not as a tag.
But it advanced the Mega Power story as a team.
Yeah, that's fine. I think, and then their other one would be the main event, I guess, the Twin Towers.
Yeah.
All right, yeah, so do they make your list? Give them three matches.
They'll probably make my list because they're the strongest team in the history of the company. Like, I mean, maybe Shawn Michaels, Triple H, DX in 2009. You know what I mean by strongest? Mm-hmm. Like,
right.
Just presented as can kill anyone. Like, I mean, Michaels and Triple H were fighting off like eight guys at a time, but like, I believe the Mega Powers could have done that in 1988. Do they do that handshake? They probably can destroy half the roster.
Well, they do it 1995 WCW, 1996.
Yeah, it doesn't count, unfortunately. And then
we saw it. I mean, they were capable of it. I guess what I'm saying.
Yeah, when they got together, and that was with age, and like, imagine what they could have done in their youth.
Right. Yeah, okay. So, yeah, I mean, they would make my list, too. I guess the question starts to become is how high do these teams creep up? You know, I think other ones like them are like the two-man power trip, right? Like Austin and Helmsley, they have a great match to their resume. How do they stack up? You know, so teams like that have that one, two, three matches, even to an extent that we talked about, Hogan and T, one match, but it's a big one. So, like, where do these teams, like, what do you see a team like the Mega Powers, Two Man Power, like, what is their absolute peak in your mind? 50-ish? Like, back 50?
Yeah. Like, they're going to be, once you run out of teams you care, like, once you run out of consistent teams you care about,
right,
before you start pilots, you're going to, this is where the Mega Powers are going to go, I think. They're going to go towards the top of teams that, like, you care less about, but you think this is, like, kind of a really cool comic and whatnot.
Right. Like, so how about, like, the Nasty Boys?
I don't know. Like, I might rank them ahead of the Nasty Boys because I think the Nasty Boys suck. Like,
right. So they're around for a couple of years, but they don't really have much.
Yeah.
You know, they have the LOD match, which is fun. But what else, you know? I guess, well, they get the Heart match.
It's good, yeah. But it's just as good, you know, like... No, you know what? The Nasties probably finish ahead of them. They're just around a bit longer.
Power and Glory.
Power and Glory is like one of those great missed opportunities teams, right? Mm-hmm. Because like they don't have really – they don't really have a huge catalog. I mean, you really have to dig, right?
Right. Their best match would be SummerSlam 90 when they destroyed
– Oh, it's so good. I think that's the best match on that show.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree. And then it's Survivor Series 90. They're not bad. They're part of that, you know, Visionaries Vipers match.
Until Hogan fucking destroys their finish in the main event,
and that's it. And then, I mean, and that's pretty much it. They get killed at WrestleMania 7. They're fine in that tag battle royal, and then you know SummerSlam 91. They have the six man, but you know, so again, limited resume, great look, great move, you know, but nothing they have touches probably or definitely doesn't touch Mega Powers, Mega Bucks, or the stuff. So, like, to me, Power and Glory is a team that has to make my top 100 because it's so cool. But how high? And how about like the Orient Express? You know, they get the Rumble 91. Well, okay, so let's say New Orient Express. They get the Rumble 91 match and like nothing else.
Just,
so obviously that gets, I think they get in on the back of that match and, you know, just their overall work in general. But do they fall behind?
But that match, is better than any Mega Powers match. It's not more important, but it's better.
Well, what do you have that at? Like 4?
I have to rewatch it. Mm-hmm. I believe I have. Oh, you know what? I think I did rewatch it. Oh no, I didn't yet. Damn it! My running thought right now is that it's at 4, but it could be higher.
And what do you have, Mega Powers, Mega Bucks?
I believe I have that at about 3.25.
Okay.
So, like, I mean, I liked it, but yeah. So, but then again, that match is so much more important than the Rockers Orient Express.
Right.
Something that, because you brought up the two-man power trip, I wonder, are you going to factor in at all? Because, I mean, look, the Mega Powers were a team, right? And had that team run rampant over the division, it might have hurt the tag team division, mm-hmm. right? Whereas, like, you can almost maybe make the argument that the two-man power trip did hurt the tag division at the time.
I hypothesize that Undertaker and Kane hurt the tag division. not the two-man power trip.
And, well, and it, but the two-man power trip were involved with Undertaker and Kane. Like, whereas Mega Powers don't have a bad match like that.
No, right? Well, like, I don't think that match is even that bad.
The Backlash?
Yeah, I think that's fine. I think it's the singles matches that are rougher. I think the tag is okay. But I think it's no, because then they also have the Benoit Jericho, which is like iconic. So No, I don't dock them too much because I think Undertaker Kane was the misstep, the booking there. Like everyone wanted them to feud with Benoit Jericho and wanted the elevation. No one wanted them to go to Undertaker Kane. So I don't think it was like a division killing thing. I think it was just the company unwilling to pull the trigger on the young guys more than anything. I think that's some of the closest comp you get is the two-man power trip and the Mega Powers, honestly. I think that's like almost a dead-on comparison.
Yeah, and then the two-man power trip have like the much better match.
Right, and you get the awesome beatdown too where they just fucking destroyed the Hardys and Lita on TV.
Lita and Lita.
I mean, they just fucking wreck shit in that. So, yeah,
but
they're an
Austin
interesting
and
comp.
Have a handshake.
You know, I could see them finishing back to back almost. You know, I think it's that close with those two teams.
Right.
So.
Yeah. Like, I think they're a fun team to have on a list. I mean, the Mega Powers breakup is much better, but.
Yes, obviously.
They're a fun one to debate. And I'd be surprised if they didn't finish on a lot of people's lists.
Right. Yeah, the short-term teams, to me, are the ones that are most interesting in this whole project. I'm really curious how some of these teams go.
Yeah, and teams like the Nasty Boys are a funny one to put them up against.
Mm-hmm.
Like, look, I will have them ahead of Money, Inc. I can guarantee you. They'll be, like, light years ahead of Money, Inc. and light years ahead of the Natural Disasters.
Well, even, like, I don't know, like, do the fucking Body Donnas make your list, you know? Like, they were fine.
They probably make it, but, like, they're
right.
At the back.
Right. DOA?
Yeah. DOA?
Skull and 8-Ball.
Oh, are they a different team on the list than the Blue Brothers?
I don't know how we have them. I'd have to look. I don't remember.
Right. I, you know, like, at the time, I'm probably going to take a conclusion. At the time, I hated every second of them. But watching back some of this stuff, I don't think their straight tag matches are actually that bad. Because
no.
Most of them are pretty fun sprints.
Right.
They're like 5-minute matches against the Acolytes where they're kicking the shit out of each other. Or LOD where they're just pounding each other, right? So.
Yeah.
You just fucking each other sprint. So.
Always pounding ass.
Yep.
All right. Why don't we take a break? We'll do more tag teams in future episodes for sure. We got a lot more to get through. So we'll work through that. We'll take a break. We'll come back for fall number two. See you a little bit. Later.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the pro wrestling only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
In the Ferrari or Jaguar, switching four lanes with the top down, screaming out money ain't a thing.
Bubble hard in the double law, flashing the rims with the window crack, holla back, money ain't a thing.
Jigga, I don't like it if it don't gleam, gleam in the hell with the price, but the money ain't a thing.
Down hard for my dog that's locked in the.
All right, Place to Be Nation, welcome back to No Holds Barred, episode 2, Aaron and me, JT. And for segment number 2, we're going to do our second fall, which is our second kind of blown out topic. And it's kind of wrestling related, but it's also sports related because we had a special request from our buddy Mike Rude, who reached out and asked if we could talk
Wait,
about the
Mike Rude. Hold on. Before you get there.
Yeah.
Mike Rude. How is it spelled?
R-U-D-H.
Oh. So, he's not like Rick Rude's son or like Bobby Rude's son.
But he is from Minnesota, so it could be Rick Rude's son.
Fair enough.
So anyway, he reached out and he wanted our thoughts on the XFL. And you said, well, I don't know anything about football. So we said, well, we'll talk about it anyway. Is that accurate?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we have Canadian football up here. So here we go.
Okay. Similar. All right. Did you have any interaction with the original XFL?
Yes. I loved it.
Okay.
Because look, my interaction, quick interaction with football. I watched football for like a year in the early 90s. I loved Philadelphia Eagles. I loved Randall Cunningham. And then I just couldn't give a shit about it. And I still can't. Like in group chats where you guys start talking about football, I'm just, all right, well, I guess for the next 6 months I'm out. And then baseball happens and I'm just sad. When the XFL started, I remember for at least the first few weeks I watched it. Like I watched it quite. I had a shirt with all the teams on the back because I just thought it was – I thought the teams were cool.
Mm-hmm.
Like I thought there was something fun about the way it was. And I had no point of reference to if it was bad football or not. So that didn't really affect me one way or another. I did find it boring by the end, but I don't know if that's because I dislike football.
I mean, the football wasn't great. There's actually really a book I'd read a few years ago, Long Bomb, about the XFL, which is interesting. So I was into it too when they announced it. I thought it was a really cool idea. I had a Las Vegas Outlaws hat that I liked quite a bit. And it was interesting. I watched a decent amount of it. I was in college at the time, and the games were Saturday night. So a lot of times, like, if we just had people over and we're drinking and having a party, like, it would be background noise. Like, I'd just have it on in the background. And then they'd have a game on Sunday afternoon. And as anyone knows that, you know, lived in a college dorm, like Sunday afternoon, you're not doing shit. You know, you are literally just like laying around because you're hungover from Saturday night. You know, you're dreading going back to class Monday. You're doing some homework, you know, whatever you're doing, you're not doing much on a Sunday afternoon. So that would be the other game. And so I did watch a decent amount of it just because I was in a position to have it on. Like, I know it sounds like a loser thing to say, like, oh, Saturday night, but like, I didn't just sit in front of the fucking game and watch it. Like I said, it was just kind of background noise. So if I was studying the film, it would have been different. I don't know, maybe. But they also,
has anyone ever studied the film?
All the games are on YouTube. If I had the time, it's one of my projects I want to do at some point. Someday is like watch those games and do something on it, but I don't have the time. So anyway, it was also unique because at the time, like these days, wrestling is, it's more everywhere. It's more ingrained in the pop culture. And I know folks like to think it's like not cool anymore, but I'd argue it's actually the coolest and most ingrained it's ever been because like nerd culture and pop culture have combined so much that, and because it's covered by ESPN, it's the closest to being presented as a sport, you know, as it has been in decades. So I actually think it's kind of cool.
Right.
In 99, 2000, like that was new for it to be kind of cool. And like wrestling stuff being out there in the mainstream was still a novelty. Like, holy shit. Like there's Vince McMahon and Jim Ross and Jesse Ventura. Like these guys are all on this NBC calling football. Like if that happened now, you know, if like JBL showed up on fucking Monday Night Football for like a segment, like it's not a big deal because whatever, they're all in bed with each other. But at the time, it still felt kind of like a novelty. So it was like, oh, cool. I watch football and here's JR and Lawler like calling the fucking game. And, you know, I'm a huge Jesse Ventura fan. So him being involved was like really neat. And, you know, they tried to do the whole show with Rusty Tillman and add in like the, you know, add in the fucking drama and all that, the feud and all that stuff. But,
him like hounding him on the sidelines.
Yeah, like all that Jesse and Tillman. I mean, it was whatever. But the biggest miss, and I've said it before, that the biggest miss was that they rushed. That they didn't do a full training camp. They didn't build up the product, and they rushed it out. And the games ended up sucking because they didn't have you're using second level players. But you're not giving them any training camp to get used to each other to learn the playbook. Like by the end, when no one was watching, the games are kind of at their best. Like that, like the games weren't bad. Like the LA Extreme, like Tommy Maddox, like they were playing pretty well. You know, like they were fine. But no one was watching at that point because everyone had eroded because the early games were a fucking disaster. And I feel like if they had taken that extra year and really built up the rosters and get the team, like, and so anyway, that all brings me around to say that I think this time, they're actually doing that, because they announced it in January of 18 and they're not coming back till 2020. So I think they're taking their time, and I'm hopeful, in quotes, like, I mean, I really don't care, but like if I'm them, I'm hoping that they were to build the teams a year out or 8 months out and give them a full training camp, you know, like to work out their playbook, to work out the chemistry, figure out the coaching, and like actually give a better product. Cause that's what it's going to come down to, is the product in the end. And I actually think it's, in a way, on the surface, it may look like it was better timing last time because they were such a hot property and there wasn't much out there. But I'd argue they're actually better today because niche stuff is so much more accepted. There's so many more channels. There's so many more ways to watch things. This, you know, back then, if you didn't watch it live, you had to record it. Like, that's when this last one, like, that was still the technology. Now you can watch it, you know, on demand or DVR, however you want to do it. So I just think, and you know, especially if they open it up to, I mean, I'm sure betting was, I'm sure you could bet on it last time, but if they do fantasy, if they integrate it into fantasy or FanDuel or something like that, like there's a lot of more opportunity, I think, if they manage the expectations for success to be some level of success. Now, I don't think it's ever going to be a massive fucking league, but I also think they can figure out a way to maybe make it like WWE today, right? Where they just kind of make some money and cruise.
I mean, what's the end game? Like, I kind of haphazardly said at the start, right? Like, we have the CFL up here, right? And the CFL is like, I guess it's actually probably the second biggest sport up here. Hockey is obviously king, but the CFL is nothing to kind of sneeze at either. Like, they'll, in some cities, like when you get to Saskatchewan, they're selling out a 40,000 seat stadium every time they have a game. Right. You know, so it's not nothing. Right now, is that where they want to go to? Is that what the, like, well, what's considered a success now for the XFL? Just that it survives, or that it grows into something that, like, is a similar size to, say, the CFL? Like,
yeah, or the Arena League, something like that. I mean,
yeah.
You know, I thought one of their other misses the first time around was trying to compete with the NFL instead of trying to build themselves into a developmental league for the NFL. Now, they're not going to do it this time because part of the hook for them is to be anti, you know, everything the NFL stands for, right? So they're going to, you know, the patriotism, and, you know, like, they're going to reach out to, like, that crew, right? Like, the, whatever, like, they're gonna, the Trump fucking league, right? I mean, that's the joke, right? That they're trying to reach is that the folks that are disenfranchised with the kneeling and the entitlement and blah 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 blah. That's gonna be what they go after.
Colin Kaepernick is not playing,
which I think is the wrong. I get it, but I also think it's the opposite. Is they should bring Kaepernick in and like embrace that. I think you're maybe set up more for success that way, but who knows? Maybe it'll work.
Wait, I got it. Here's what you do. You bring him in, okay? And first game, he kneels, okay? Owner of the company, he comes out. You're going to do things the easy way or the hard way.
That's it. You have your Austin.
Kaepernick fucking tackles the shit out of Vince McMahon, wherever the owner is. And then throughout the games, we see all kinds of new interventions from people that we never seen in a football game before. People's music plays to distract Kaepernick when he's trying to throw the ball.
So you just want to script the whole thing.
I think this. Well, the Kaepernick storyline, anyway. Like, the rest, I could care less about. But this Colin Kaepernick storyline, and then you could bring in, who's the guy? The praying guy,
Tebow.
What's his name? Tebow. You bring him in as the corporate quarterback.
There you go.
Right. This is going to be my corporate quarterback, and you have him vying for. For Kaepernick's spot on, I don't know, the Chicago railroad workers or whatever the fuck teams are called.
You're saying it jokingly. I think Tebow is their guy. Like, if I'm them, I'm putting money in Tebow's pocket and be like, hey, no one else is giving you a chance, Boudreaux, but you can come here and be the fucking, you know, star of our league. We'll build this whole thing around you. Like, that is the fucking guy if I'm them. And you put a team in Florida and you put them on that fucking team And that is where, I mean, if they want to have a shot, like, that's what I do, is get him in as the quarterback of a team of Florida.
They could also dig up the bones of Joe Montana, have a Joe Montana skeleton, like an animated skeleton running a team. Would that work?
Sure. So Vince has also said he wants to play an existing NFL market. So that takes out some of the cities from the original XFL, like a Birmingham, Memphis, Orlando. I think, you know, I think there's an opportunity for a city like a San Diego or an Oakland where there won't be an NFL team, but there may be fans pissed off enough at the NFL that they would go. Right. San Diego, I think, wouldn't, because I think they're just pissed and are just going to say, fuck it. We have perfect weather. We're not going to football games. But a city like Oakland could be an interesting one. Especially if you tie it into ballers and you have The Rock own them. You could do that.
Oakland assholes.
Right. There you go. I mean, I'd look at cities like that, that are, you know, maybe pissed off that they lost their NFL team. St. Louis could be another one. Potentially. The big story that came out a couple weeks ago or last week was that they're actually thinking that Vince is Alpha Entertainment is going to spend closer to $500 million in the first 3 years at $100
million. That's crazy.
But that's in the first 3 years, right?
I mean, I would imagine all these things add up.
The what?
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So
it's just such a big gamble with that kind of money. Like,
it is. It's insane. I mean, I think this is Vince's, like, Linda spent all the money on all the fucking failed Senate bids, right? So I think this is like, I'm taking my money and doing this. I'm sure the egomaniac that he is, I'm sure it's always bothered him that it failed, right? I mean, I'm sure he never got over it. And I think he got the itch, probably did the 30 for 30, and is like, let me give it another shot. I got money now, more money than I even had then. And, you know, the landscape has changed. Now, what also potentially fucked him was his boy, Charlie Ebersole, Dick Ebersole's son, also announced a competitive league as well. So, and he had produced the 30 for 30. So I don't know when the hell they're, you know, they're trying to beat the XFL to market. So, and I guess they're also here. There are 8 markets. They already have theirs: Atlanta, Orlando, Birmingham, Memphis, San Antonio, Salt Lake, San Diego, Phoenix. So they go San Diego. So if I'm Vince, I avoid those because there's going to be an oversaturation in those markets. I'd go.
They should put a team in Toronto.
Yeah.
I'm
with you.
If you want to get like the Canadian market involved, you Canadian team, and Toronto has been trying, as far as I understand, they've been trying to get an NFL team forever.
They were trying to sell it.
I don't know why you want to build.
Right. Well, yeah. They probably figured they have the local fan base, right?
Yeah. But to get out of a city Toronto is, like, it's bigger than almost the most U.S. cities. Like, there's only a handful that are bigger than it. So the market's there for sure.
Right.
I think it might be something interesting. And I personally can't wait to see all the team names and all the madness, like, with that. Like, because to me, that was my favorite part of the last XFL.
Right.
Like, I love that there's a team called the Demons.
Well, see, it's funny because they were in Vegas last time, and now it's going to be tough. I mean, they could try, but with the Raiders going there, I think they just get completely overshadowed. I like Toronto. I think Toronto, St. Louis, Oakland, and then you throw a team in Texas somewhere. Mike Rudin and I had talked about San Antonio, but it looks like the AAF will be there. I don't know. So, I mean, you know he's going to do New York or Jersey. Like, he's going to do somewhere in there, right? I mean, he has to. You know, Hartford maybe, or somewhere New England-ish. Does he go there? And then, you know, he's going to want a team in Florida. So, you know, where does that go? And then, you know, it looks like they're doing Salt Lake in the AF. So maybe do you look at like a Portland perhaps, or a Seattle? I think the appetite is big enough in Seattle to maybe support it. So maybe you go there.
Plus you get the Vancouver people.
Right. I guess the question is, how much travel do they want to worry about? Like, do they want, like, Seattle's kind of far for everyone. So do they want to worry about teams going that far out?
Well, I mean, does that actually matter when, like, you're probably playing, what, one game a week?
Yeah, it's decent. Like, I mean, you're right. It's not like baseball where you're flying all over the place. But Seattle is a long trip for anyone. So, I mean, like, it depends if you're only really going to play within your division. But if you get a team in New York and you go to Seattle, like, I think, I think it's just a consideration. The Seattle's like the furthest point for everyone to travel to. I think it'd be a good city to do, but they may try and stay more clustered than spread out. So the rumor is the average salary for 40-man roster will be around $75,000, with in-demand players making more than that. The first time around, they're making $45,000. So, and there also is the insurance to cover any injuries. So.
Well, they were making $45,000, but didn't they have all kinds of bonuses for winning?
Yes.
Which I always thought was a good idea. Like, I like that.
Yeah, no, me too. I thought it made a lot of sense. Obviously, UFC does it too. Would you see this as successful in any way if it ends up on WWE Network, or do you think they need to be somewhere else for it to be successful?
If he's doing it on WWE Network, it then becomes a question of what. I mean, there's a big question of why he's doing it. Like, I mean, this is a man who, like, has never been satisfied with just being the greatest wrestling promoter ever. Like, that's never been – that's clearly never been enough for him. And it's sad because everything he's tried on the outside has failed, right? So, like, is he just that – like, he doesn't – I mean, I might be wrong, but – does this man watch football? Like, is he passionate about this?
He
like,
seems to be. I mean, he always talks about it. Now, does he watch it now? I don't know, but I'm sure he's got some nostalgia for it. Like, he probably grew up watching it, you know, because the whole thing the first time was like, I want my football back, you know, like all that stuff. So, I mean, is he a diehard that watches
that feels
every week?
Like,
yeah. I don't know.
But was that just a thing he was saying? Like, this is a man who, like, they tell him, apparently he just works all nonstop like a goddamn Terminator, right? Like,
right.
So, like, when does he have time to watch a football game? Like, is the last football game he's seen, like, with Joe Namath playing quarterback?
I think he may watch it while he's working. I don't know. Like, I think he legitimately likes football. I don't think you pump $500 million into something that you don't like. So, I mean, I think he has to have some affinity for football. Like, I think on some level.
Like, he pumped fucking that much into his wife. He doesn't like her.
No, but she had to, or she was going to say, I'm out, I'm taking all your money for cheating on me all those years.
Everybody all the secrets.
Well, look at the things he's pumped big money into, right? It's wrestling, bodybuilding, obviously loves. I got to think football's up there, you know, and the other money is in this, even the Dodie Studios, he kind of ramped down, like he put some money in. So I don't think he's a big movie buff, but the other three, I think, is where he's put his big money and his big goals are three probably passions of his.
How dare you say he's not a big movie buff? You saw him in Beyond the Mat. We make movies.
Making movies, pal.
Look, all I hope is that if this is anywhere near, like, the CFL was a nine team league, mm-hmm. right, at one point, and there were two teams called the Rough Riders at the same time. All right, so I just hope that the creativity flows a little more with the XFL than with the CFL. But I wouldn't mind seeing them some of the CFL rules. Like, right. Can we go to three downs? That'd be great.
Do they – all right. So I think it cannot be under the network to be a success. I think even if it's fucking Facebook or Amazon or something, right, it's going to be somewhere other than his home network. Now, can they have replays? Maybe, you know, whatever. But for the first run game, I think it has to be somewhere else. You know, you got Scott's harebrained idea that Fox signed SmackDown to get the XFL, which I think it might be the most whacked out idea I've ever heard. Now, could you say Vince gave them SmackDown as trying to get the XFL on? Yes, but I don't think Fox wanted the XFL so bad that they went and paid $1 billion to SmackDown.
No, they're not going to – why would they – for the – why would they concedingly like take SmackDown as a concession when it's actually a ratings draw to get the show that was like one of the worst rated shows of all time?
Correct. Yeah, it's stupid. Now, could Vince say to them, hey, you know, let's build the brand a little bit, take the XFL. Like, they got Fox Sports 1 that needs program, Fox Sports 2 that needs. So, I mean, could the XFL end up on Fox Sports 2 or some shit? Like, yes, I think that's entirely possible. All right, real quick, what's your over under for seasons?
Two.
So they get through a second more than the first time around.
No. Oh. I thought you meant we were like naming a number for over under.
Well, we can. Either way. Well, yeah. What is your guess?
I think they get through two.
And then why does it fold? Just
I think it does
ratings, attendance, and that's it.
lack of interest. Yeah, like Vince dies. Vince is assassinated.
Would that be the ultimate tragedy for him? Is that it takes off and then he dies? Like the XFL, like it takes off like right as he dies or something like that. Like he doesn't get to realize the success of it finally. He doesn't get lauded for it. He dies before it takes off.
Well, clear. Yeah, and he dies on air. Culminates storyline.
Colin Kaepernick apologizes and breaks his neck, and that's it. All right, well.
He pile drives. There's no pile drivers in wrestling, but they do it in football.
That's why. They're spending all this money, and wrestlers are underpaid. And here you go. They get to do pile drivers, too. whatever. It's not my money. It's interesting. We'll see what happens. I mean, the odds are very much stacked against him.
What's your prediction on the years?
I don't think he'll give up as easy, and I think he would have kept going. NBC pulled the plug. So I think it depends if he finds a willing partner and you know, what the deal is for. I'm going to say they make it – I'll go one more than you. I think they get through at least three.
Okay.
I think there's more of a world for it now than there was then. Like, because I feel like there's so many backup options. Like, say they start on Fox and Fox says, fuck you, we're done. Like, there's a million other options now. Be in sports. Like, there's so many channels out there now that would possibly pay. And I think Vince would put the money in to keep it running. Whereas I don't know if he had that before. And also before, NBC was part owner. Like, they owned half of it. Whereas I think he's going to own the whole thing this time. So I don't think he'll fold as easily. I'm not saying it'll be a success to get through 3 years, but I don't think he'll throw the towel in before then. Because they're saying this story from Darren Rovell about the $500 million is through the league's first three seasons. So, like, if he's willing to go that far, I don't think he's going to look at it 2 years in. He spent $375 and says, oh, I'm done. If he's earmarked the $500 million, like, I think he'll... You know, like, my point is, like, he's not going to bankrupt him until he spends that $500 million, probably. So, if they're smart about it, that'll get him through three seasons, I think that's where it'll get them.
Yeah, I just worry that he might, like, he might get to two seasons and find out everything's much more expensive.
Right, it's possible.
And then have already spent $500 million. Now, quick one. How soon before they integrate something from wrestling into the football?
Halfway through season one.
Yeah.
As soon as the ratings take their first dip, we'll see, you know, Roman Reigns out there interviewing people, whatever the fuck, shaking hands with the quarterback.
Like doing that trigger thing on his fist in between things.
Now, the question is, do they actually put any wrestlers that they don't have anything to do onto the football teams?
Well, I mean, they should probably build a team around Roman Reigns as the quarterback.
Right. Right? Get him out of the ring, get him on the football field. Yeah.
Right?
So,
would anybody actually be appropriate to put on a team?
Kane's
big.
Yes, Kane could go. I mean, Reigns, I think, played football, right? So, I mean, he could probably go.
I don't have Jim Ross around anymore to tell me who played football. It's hard. It's hard to figure it out now.
Brock can finally realize his dream, go play pro football.
Right? So. If the movies will insure him.
True. All right, why don't we take a break, our last break. When we come back, we're going to hit fall number 3, and then we'll do our top 5 tonight. Which came as a surprise. I spoke into his eyes. I thought you died alone, a long, long time ago. Police Foundation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PoliceFoundation.com. We offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Police Foundation Wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, along with Main Event, Survey Says, the Monday Night Wars, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction show, as well as Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver special network podcasts and pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Match of the Week podcasts, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Through the Years, World Cast, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Center Stage, and Letters from Kayfabe, plus much more. And on our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as Talkin' Pop, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, NBA Team, PTBN Play, Sunday Groove, Breaking Balls, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the hard-traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversations, Geek and Sassy, and Marvel Age Podcasts.
You can find all of these current shows, plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback today. All these shows, plus others, available at PlaySpeedNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects, and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaySpeedNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaySpeedNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
I would swallow my pride, I would choke on the rinds, but the lack thereof would leave me empty inside. Swallow my doubt, turn it inside out, find nothing but faith in nothing. I wanna put my tender heart in a blender, watch it spin round to a beautiful oblivion. Rendezvous, then I'm through.
Okay, Place to Be Nation fans and listeners, we are back, JT and Aaron, on No Holds Barred Episode 2. We've talked some GWE tag teams, we've talked some XFL, and now we're going to do our pop culture segment, and it's a new idea that we have called Sitcom Roulette. And what we've done is we have this random wheel randomizer thing that we found, and we've entered in, I don't know, like a dozen or so sitcoms, great sitcoms. We're going to spin the wheel, and whatever one comes up, we're going to talk about it. We're going to go about 15 minutes, and we'll see how many we can get in, and we'll rank as we go. How's that sound?
It sounds lovely.
I'm spinning. Here we go. Here we go.
Woo! Spin that wheel.
And you can't, I mean, you can't write it any better. And I swear to you, this is all 100% legitimate. Seinfeld is the first one that comes up on the wheel. The wheel knows us well.
Bum, 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 bum. Yeah, well, I mean, if you don't understand our Seinfeld love, then you haven't followed the years long project we've been working on at PlaceToBeNation.com. What more can be said about Seinfeld? Like, the greatest of the traditional sitcoms?
Yeah, I think so. It's also fitting, by the way, is 1989 today is when the pilot aired, so perfect timing as always for us. I think it's still the great. I mean, because I think you have to factor in too traditional sitcom style on broadcast TV, and the comedy and the writing they worked in into that scenario and that situation to build four iconic characters plus an entire universe without relying on tricks, extended episodes, swearing, you know, just in that traditional format. Yeah. I mean, it has to be, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And the fact that it, for the most part, still holds up really well today.
Right. I was going to ask you that, how well it holds up for you.
Yeah. I mean, look, there's obviously the gaps, right? Of like, oh, why doesn't he just, like today he just uses a cell phone and that problem wouldn't happen. Right.
Right.
But I think the humor in itself is just so universal. It's in the same way that, like, we still study Shakespeare today because he deals in human nature and that doesn't change. Like, Seinfeld is so – I mean, he's precise with his comedy, but it's from a perspective of just things that people are always going to experience. It's about social awkwardness and, like, people being late and, you know, like that's never going to change no matter the technology. So – and the humor is based around that. It's based around humanity as opposed to circumstance. And I think that's such a boon.
Now, you struggled a bit with season 9 as of late. So we took a hiatus, but now we're back. And we've been doing, you know, the last two episodes you have not liked. You've panned. And
I've always enjoyed season 9, but I could see, like, part of the issue with it is that they do get a little, and I think this happens with a lot of sitcoms. Like, I think it happened with The Office as well, where, like, toward the end, they kind of start to run out of ideas, right? So it's like they almost become cartoonish or, like, go outside the realm of reality and really stretch, like, the characters become a little bit more parody of themselves. I think a lot of these shows peak. I think they peak in the middle seasons when the characters become fully fleshed out. And then by the end, it's almost like, all right, we've done all we can with these fucking characters. And now they become almost parodies of themselves. Like, Kramer becomes even more, you know, whatever, to use a word. I mean, just retarded, right? And Ray, he's even like he starts off kind of a weirdo, and then he finds that groove in seasons 5, 6, 7. And now he's just, like, kind of a dunce. You know what I mean? Like,
well, now he just doesn't understand anything about anything.
Right. He's just an idiot, right? And we start with Homer Simpson, too, right? I mean, on The Simpsons. In early Simpsons season, Homer is just, like, kind of an angry dad. And then he's just kind of a heart of gold. And then he becomes, like, an idiot, right?
Just a complete moron.
Right. And so it's, like, by the end of a lot of these shows, the characters take on the worst possible traits of what they were. And I mean, I think you saw in The Office with Michael Scott, where he starts off as, like, this asshole boss, but then he finds that groove, and then late he's just kind of like a comic character of himself, like the same as like he doesn't understand anything, right? Nothing.
Right.
So I think that's, like, a natural evolution of a lot of sitcoms. And the good thing with Seinfeld is you don't see it until almost halfway through season 9 is when that creeps in, where they start to go to these crazy premises instead of just staying grounded in reality.
Yeah, and I just find it – maybe it's because we took the hiatus also, but I just find the changes so jarring. Like for me, like, Elaine is now just a whore, just a complete whore.
Right, and like, taking the worst, like, of her quality, right, and just amplified it.
Yeah, and, like, she always had lots of boyfriends and it wouldn't matter, but, like, she's at a point now where, like, she looks at a man and she's, like, fucking wet as October, right? Like,
right.
So it can't those are the things. And I think by season 9, you can also really tell that Larry David's not there anymore.
Right.
Because the stuff they're doing is just the thing with the last one we watched with The Wiz, like, and that guy doing that dance in the restaurant. It's like, what it feels like you're watching a completely different show.
Yeah.
And I don't get it. And it's sad for me that, like, watching Frank and Estelle Costanza still didn't pop me. It's like, okay, like, how'd they get in the woods? Like,
right.
Like, you know, I don't want to say it sucks anymore because I mean, we're only at, like, season episode 5 or something. Right. So it's possible it turns around. But there's been a change in it. There's definitely been a change. And but that being said, I don't really knock it that much. There's a couple other shows I'm sure we'll talk about where I feel they get dinged a bit more because there's a couple seasons that are really garbage. But by contrast, there's some shows that are just consistently excellent that we'll talk about. And same, the opposite is true. So, I mean, I think it's kind of, I don't think it's surprising, and maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think it's surprising that I haven't enjoyed a traditional sitcom since Seinfeld.
Right.
Like, all the big ones today, I mean, I they don't connect with me at all. Like, I don't care about Big Bang Theory. I don't care about 2 and a Half Men, which my dad... My dad would always ask me, "Did you see 2 and a Half Men last night?" every time, and I've never watched. Like, I watch it to see what it was. But even, like, something that was as popular as Everybody Loves Raymond, like, that I thought on some level was good, didn't pop me. You know, like, I think it kind of broke the mold in a lot of ways, and I don't think there was any going back to that format after it was almost somewhat perfected.
The only one I liked well enough, and it started right after Seinfeld ended, was King of Queens. And again, I think I have a tie-in of Jerry Stiller.
You get Jerry Stiller yelling.
But I do think there's a lot of good in King of Queens. Like, I enjoyed that. Like, that's when I have, like, when DVDs were a thing, like, we had all the seasons, just about all the seasons on DVD. Like, it was what I'd throw in at night. Like, I'm talking about that wheelhouse right before, like, the boom and the rebirth of the sitcom, like, which starts with what? Like, The Office in 05, right? I mean, that's when kind of it... you know, the Phoenix Rises. So in that kind of dead period between Seinfeld ending and The Office, you know, rebirth, like, I think that gap is like where King of Queens kind of filled, like, during that time for me. Now, if King of Queens came around today, I don't I don't know if I'd watch it, but during that time period, like when there was kind of an opening, like I thought it actually did a decent enough job to fill the void.
Well, there was an opening of like the big sitcom, but there was still some excellent comedy happening during that period.
Oh, for sure. But yeah, as far as like the mainstream.
Yeah.
And even The Office didn't really take off for a couple seasons, right? I mean, the first season didn't do very well, but.
We'll talk about it when we get to The Office.
But for Seinfeld, that last season, they really take, like you said, Elaine becomes a whore. George becomes just like a fat kind of dope. You know, like it's just. They go lowest common denominator with their characters. And I think it. I'm trying to think of the way I was going to put it. Is it. Yeah, they just stray from what made the show. And I don't want to go too far because I do like season 9 and I want to see where some of this comes in. But there's this blip where they're trying to figure out how to manage it. I think they just exhausted so much that it becomes very meta. Like season 9 is extremely meta. Like there's a lot of like references to, oh, I really like this coffee shop. You know, like stuff like that. Like, you know, where they're like.
Yeah.
They're referencing kind of the tropes of the show. Like you get a lot of that in there.
It's kind of hacky.
Right. It is hacky. It is. That's a good word for it. But it's so good still. The individual performances are so good that like they overcome that in a lot of the episodes. Like I don't think there's too many like the ones we've seen. Like when I think of season 9, I still think of like the car dealership. Like week is still to come for us. And, like that's a great episode. That has hallmarks of the older, like it's all in one place. And the Frogger, the Puerto Rican Day Parade, you know, I mean, like there's a lot of really good season 9 stuff to come. I think we're just and we've seen this in other seasons too. I don't know if we've had some as bad if you've considered, but I think we saw blips in all the seasons, right? There was like a drop, you know, here and there. But I do think season 9 has a lot of, and I'm trying to pull up the, and I was trying to find the friggin'. Episode listings for it, but
yeah, I mean, we'll go pull it up. Like for me, like it's like what I come down hardest on is the same thing I would praise hardest, which was the writing. I always thought when the show was at its best, the writing was tight. There wasn't a line wasted. Everything drove. Every single line spoken drove to the climax of the show. Whereas the last couple episodes, I have not seen that, and the episodes I have criticized in the past have also had that kind of similar problem.
Right. All right, like we saw, like, you know, but the next one we're going to talk about is Merv Griffin, which is like one of my favorites. Like, I think that's a fucking fantastic episode. So we got the dealership, the reverse peephole. That's a good one with fucking Joe Mayo. The burning, which is where they do the, let me pull it up really quick. Oh, where Putty becomes religious. Like that's a good one where the Jerry's girlfriend gets gonorrhea. Like I said, the Frogger, the Puerto Rican Day, like there's still a lot of good ones in that season. The strike, that's Festivus. Obviously we still have that to come. So there's a lot of good stuff in there. I just think we happened to hit a blip, but I do think character wise, we do see a lot of what we're talking about. It's the dumbing down of these characters to their extreme and the storylines become less. Most of Seinfeld's best stuff is all grounded in reality. Like you said, like it's, this guy, Jerry wants to help this guy. You know, he feels bad because the restaurant's not doing well and he ends up fucking up and making it worse, right? I mean, that's just like a simple idea that they like you said, they use, you know, human characteristics in versus like, you know, Jerry buys a van or wins a van or is, whatever, receives it as compensation. And this kid that, you know, is a crybaby that he knows from back of the day. So he accepts it. Kramer buys it. And then George's parents end up banging it in the wood. Like that stuff just gets so.
Yeah, it's too much.
I mean, even as great as Merv Griffin is, like Kramer finding a set and setting it up in his house and thinking he's on TV. You know, like that's a lot there, right? I mean, it's great.
I'm a little worried. Because here's the thing. Like, I remember. I mean, I hadn't seen the one where George is trying to meld sex and eating since I was a teenager. I just hadn't seen it since then. And I remember thinking that was hilarious. And when I watched it back, it was like, oh, this is just fucking stupid. Like, this is just so ridiculous. Like, this is a guy that's like done nothing but try to get sex for like 8 seasons.
Right.
And now it's suddenly not enough that he has to fucking eat entire sandwiches.
Right. Yeah, no, it's like they stop. 9 is like very outside of the continuum of the characters. Like it's almost like they almost didn't want to come back. Then they came back and it's like, all right, it kind of reminds me in a little bit of, at a less level, because I think this season of Curb was so great, but kind of like Curb, where like Larry David was unloading all these ideas he had. It almost felt like they're just like emptying the chamber on like all these ideas they have. Even if whether they make sense or not, they're going to do all these things, right? So they're just trying to get them all in.
Yeah. They're
trying to get all the shit in.
Yeah. Yeah, and I hope it moves past it, because like I said, like there's something still brilliant about it. I read an article today. It was an article chastising Jerry Seinfeld for Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee, that there wasn't enough enough of a substantial conversation happening about today's political climate and whatnot in those shows, and how he had a responsibility and blah, 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 blah. And as I was reading it, it struck me, and I didn't know we were going to talk about this today, but it struck me how brilliant he was to not include any of that in Seinfeld.
Right.
So that, for instance, like in 20 years, no one's going to give a shit about the Roseanne reboot.
Right.
It's going to have no context. It's not going to matter. Like, and there's room for that too. But I think the reason why it's so timeless and the reason why we can still turn back on it today is because they ignored that stuff and just were like, I don't know, what happens when your dad likes a guy named Lloyd Braun more than you?
Right. Yeah, the most you would get is here and there was some local New York stuff, right? I mean, they'd have Giuliani on, or, you know, like whatever. They have like a little bit here and there. But no, you're right. They pretty much strayed away from anything like that. I mean,
it was never the focal point either.
Right. Yeah, it was always in the background. No, I mean, it's a brilliant show. I think the biggest qualms with like a season 9 is maybe that it just doesn't hold up. Like you said, in the time period, maybe George with the sex and the meats is like real funny because it's, you're just in the moment. It's a great show. But and I think looking back, you could see, whereas like some of the stuff feels dated in the earlier seasons, the comedy is so sharp and the acting is so great that you can get by it, right? But watching it back now, some of those other ones, it's like, okay, there's so much other great stuff. Some of these just are lagging. But real quick, what's your power ranking for the main four?
I was just about to say that to you. Bow, bow, bow. Okay, oh, well, now this is interesting because this is entirely based on the rewatch, because it would have been completely different going in. And what I love about our rewatch is it allowed me to discover all these things. So number four for me is Jerry. What's your number four?
It's actually Elaine.
Wow.
I have not enjoyed Elaine as much on this rewatch. And like I read it and like you praise her, you know, Jordan's fucking in love with her. And like Andy praises her a lot. And it's like, I'm watching it and I'm like kind of waiting for like, but I feel like she's marginalized a lot. And like, I feel like a lot of it, I don't know. Her stuff is always the weakest to me in all these episodes.
Do you think it might be because you're a misogynist?
I love women though.
Yeah. But do you respect them?
Yeah. Cause I wanted to like Elaine.
So I find that she's the one I'm most impressed with her performance.
I can see that argument because you can say she's given the least to work with, right? And she makes it work. So when I rank these, like it's thin. I mean, it is like razor thin all four. But rewatch, she's the one I've given her the least amount of best actor each episode. You know what I mean? Like she's been like the least amount of the big for me. Jerry would be my three.
So Jerry's your three?
Yeah.
So my three would be George.
Okay.
Which, going into this, I would have sworn up and down he'd be my number one.
Right.
And then my number two is Elaine.
Mm-hmm. Mine's George, and my one's Kramer.
Yeah, and would you have thought that going into the rewatch?
No, because I always assumed he was the physical comedy and the, you know, kind of the goofiness. Because I think season 9 is in my head, and he's real goofy in 9. But he carries so many episodes on his back.
So good.
Just on his back.
He's the best physical comedian I've ever seen.
Yeah.
He does this one bit where he breaks into a cabin. He's trying to go through the window.
Yeah.
I think it's when they burn down the cabin, actually. Yes. And the things he does so many things with his body. Just some context. It's what I do for a living. I'm a theater actor. And like the things he does with his body, like, it's not that I'm jealous because I can't do them, but there is some of that. But it's also that I just can't comprehend them.
Right.
Like and most things, like I can look at a complicated sword fight and be like, okay, I see what they're doing. Like probably can't. What is he doing? Like to achieve these things, and his acting is bang on, and he's just incredible.
Yeah, no, his timing's great. Even the little noises he makes, the, you know, like shit like that. You know, it's like it's like amazing, like on command when he could do that stuff. And he's such a beautiful aloofness about him, in that he lives in this own little universe. You know, some of my favorite stuff, like when he goes and gets the fucking fake job at the, like that is like such a brilliant. Actually, have we even seen that one yet?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay,
it's earlier on.
That's right. Yeah.
We have to let you go. Well, that's okay, because I don't work.
Yeah, I don't really work. That's what makes it so difficult. You know, he's got the fucking crackers in the briefcase. You know, it's, I mean, it's just like, it's so perfect. That whole episode with him and Jerry, you know, where they're like a married couple. You know, he's like, oh, I'm working as it's a bizarro world, I think, right? Is that one? I think so. I mean, that's just like an amazing episode. And that's season 8. That may be one of the best, just because you get the bizarro world, you get the man hands, you get the Kramer working. There's like so much going on in that episode, the Forbidden City.
Yeah.
Just amazing.
That's one of the things that like that struck me rewatching it, was like I'd hit an episode, I'd be like, okay, it's this episode. But then it's like, no, it's not just this episode. It also has this, this, and this.
Right.
Like it's not just one classic moment. It's got like three classic storylines that they actually packed into one episode.
Which is why I think that may be the best episode. Because it has like four iconic stories. Like very few of the Seinfelds have like all four are like very memorable. Like if I had to rank them, right, you go, I don't even know. I mean, like Kramer working is like one of my favorite of all time. But you go Bizarro World, which is iconic. You have Man Hands, which is iconic. And then to a lesser extent, George and the Forbidden City. But that's like still a really good story. Like that's like, you know, top notch. Like that could have been a one or a two in other episodes. And it's pretty much the fourth here. I think when you piece it all together, it's like, geez, this is just like, you know, next level.
Would you say that that's your favorite episode you've watched on the rewatch?
We have the spreadsheet, right? I have to see what the other 10s are. I mean,
yeah. Just quickly, like one off the top of your head that like is standing out as a favorite.
I mean, obviously the gay one, right? The outing. I mean, that's great.
Right.
Here we go. I pulled it up right now. Let's see. I'm trying to look at my other 10s. Let's see. Okay. I give it a decent amount of 10. So I got the Bubble Boy, the contest, the outing, puffy shirt, cigar store Indian, marine biologist, the raincoats, the opposite. Like, these are all 10s. The race, the doorman, Fusilli Jerry, hot tub, soup Nazi, the rye, showerhead, the doll, Bizarro Jerry, chicken roaster, little Jerry, Van Buren boys, and the voice. I give all those 10s.
Got a lot of 10s. I don't know if I've given as many 10s.
Yeah. I can tell you right now.
I know I've given more ones.
Now you've got a decent amount of tens. You have the fire, the Chinese woman, the Andrea Doria, the pick, library, face painter, comeback, yada yada, the contest, marine biologist, the opposite, Fusilli Jerry, soup Nazi, showerhead, doll.
See, like an episode like the pick is one of those ones that like I'd forgotten how much good stuff's in it.
Right.
It's like, oh my god, it is the pick, which is fine. But then you get like Kramer auditioning for Calvin Klein, like those are like you forget how much is packed into one. And I'll forever love the Chinese woman for Frank Costanza screaming at his wife. You want a divorce? You've got one. This is such a mean way to do it.
Right. Right in front of everyone. The doll is one of my favorite. Obviously, it's got the place to be thing.
Right. Oh, and the maestro.
Yeah, the maestro is so good. All right. Well, there you go. Seinfeld. So that's the only one we're going to get through tonight. We went 21 instead of 15. So there you go. We'll put that at number one tonight. And next time we do sitcom roulette, we'll see where we go and how things stack up. But I'm glad Seinfeld came up. It was good to kind of do that first because it's easy to talk about. All right. So before we wrap up, why don't we quickly do our sudden death errand? That's our top five segment of the episode. And tonight we're going to have a wrestling twist on this. We're going to do our favorite live wrestling event experiences.
Dun, 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 dun. Bom, 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 bom.
Okay. All right. Do you have any honorable mentions?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I just want to say quickly, like, I was at the shows themselves weren't great, but I was at the 10-minute Hogan ovation after WrestleMania 18. Which was just incredible to be part of. And I was also at the Raw in the summer of 2005 when Michaels did that promo where they played Bret Hart's music. And I've never heard a bigger pop than that. Like if he had come out, I think people might have died of excitement.
There's a chance.
Like, It was so loud. Like, it was so, so loud. And Michaels was so wonderful in that promo. Those would be my honorable mentions.
Yeah, so I get a few, I guess, that are moment-based as well that I wouldn't put in. Like, Survivor Series 02, the Steiner pop, and the Elimination Chamber with Shawn winning. Like, those are great. The Raw in 02 I went to with Jeff Hardy, Undertaker in the ladder match. Like, that was a ton of fun. I've been to so many recently. Like, nothing really jumps out as, like, you know, they've all been great with the Place of the Nation stuff. You know what I mean? Like, so it's hard to, like, limit. Like, yeah. They all kind of, like Rumble 14 and 15 were great times. But when I look at those shows, I'm like, oh, all right. Well, they're memorable, but, you know, are they, you know, some of my favorite all-time experiences? I think I have ones that edge out. But, you know, there's a lot. And one other one I would put in there is Rumble 94, my first pay-per-view.
Right.
So I'd put that as an honorable mention. It's not inside my top five. But I just, like I said, I've been to so many lately that they all start to run together. Like, I went to those SummerSlams in Brooklyn, like, which were fine. They were fun because we were in the luxury box. Like, those are great experiences, yeah. But they all kind of run together.
They've also beaten the love of the product out of you. But we touched on that last week.
Right. All right. So what's your number five?
My number five is a sentimental pick, and I hope you will appreciate it. It's Money in the Bank 2014. Mm-hmm. That was in Boston. And the reason that I have that on my list is it was the first show that I'd gone to with you and Scott, and I think Roger was there too, and Andy.
Yep.
And I don't think Brad was there. I think that was only Rumble. But it was really great to meet everybody and to join this kind of community that that I've been talking to and listening to for a while. And the show was pretty good too. You got Rollins winning the Money in the Bank, Cena mm-hmm. winning the title. It was a great Usos Wyatt family match. So that one, for more sentimental reasons, I'd put Money in the Bank 2014.
That actually has one of my favorite all-time memories, is you doing the Brodus Clay dance in front of that lady.
What? I don't even remember.
You were going to the bathroom or the concession, and Brodus was coming out, and they were playing Somebody Call Your Mama, and you stop in front of this lady and do this fucking dance. I don't even know how to even recreate it. You're, like, swinging your hips, and you're, like, moving your arms, like waving in front, and you just stopped in front of her and did it. And she's just, like, staring at you, and then you just leave. And it, like, whenever I hear this song, like, that's the image that's in my head, and that's what I think of from that show, was your ridiculous dance on this woman.
Your number five.
All right, so my number five is a I'm gonna say it's a three-way tie, which I know is gonna sound lame off the bat, but here's why.
Fuck you.
Yeah, but here's why because they're all they're all similar for one different reason, and that's the triumvirate of WrestleManias. I've been to four in the last five, I don't know, what's 2013? So 6 years if you count by year. I went to 29, 32, 33, 34. So I'm leaving 32 off because
you
as great as
the two best ones.
Huh?
You skipped the two best ones.
I know. Well, New Orleans at 30 was not doable for me at the time. And right. Neither was Santa Clara. But anyway, so 29, you know, not the best show, but obviously super memorable just because of it was the first big tailgate, first time we met a lot of the crew, you know, like all that stuff. So there's so much memory baked in that whole trip. There's just so much going on. Like, we've done that whole podcast on that trip. There's so many memories in there. Every step of the way was, like, crazy. So, like, that's there. I'm skipping 32, so I'm going to give it a break. I mean, I could have said the quartet, but because 32 is memorable in its own way, but the show is just so interminable. So 33... Yeah. Was the best of the three manias, I think, like in the atmosphere. Like, our seats were great. The weather was perfect. You know, even though I was snuggling next to Pete the whole show. The Hardy return was, like, an all-time live moment for me because I'm such a Hardy fan. And, like, that was so cool the way they did it. And, like, I have a video on my phone of me just screeching like a fucking schoolgirl when they come out. So, like, that was great. And seeing Brock and Goldberg, like, that match was awesome live. And it's been awesome to rewatch. And then 34, more for the whole weekend. Like, I've talked about it ad nauseum. I've gotten my balls busted about it, but I don't care. It was, like, one of the greatest weekends of my life, going to New Orleans for that trip. The drive down, like, the whole atmosphere, just zero responsibility for 4 days. Like, just doing whatever I wanted to do, staying up late. Like, all of it. You know what I mean? Just, like, the whole atmosphere, going to NXT, going to Mania, the Ronda Rousey match I loved. Like, just everything about it that weekend and that show was like amazing to me. So those three, they all blend. None stands out above the rest for different reasons, but they're all like special to me. Does that make sense why I went with the three?
Yeah. Okay. I just bust your balls, but you're going to see. I'm going to do some bullshit later too. So.
Okay. All right. So my number four is actually also from this year, and that is NXT Philadelphia from the Rumble, which had the awesome Gargano Almas match. And this narrowly edged out NXT New Orleans, which I also went to, only because I liked Gargano Almas like a tick better than Gargano Ciampa. And that Philly show, the back-to-back, those might have been the two greatest nights of wrestling I've ever been to. Back-to-back was that in the Rumble with Nakamura and Asuka winning and Ronda debuting. But that NXT, that match was just like, I mean, I've never been, I've been rarely that enveloped into a match like I was. And we had great seats, great shot of Zelina Vega's ass the whole time.
Perfect.
You know, it was just like, the whole thing was just amazing. All the near falls and everything else. I was so sucked into that match. It was just tremendous. So yeah, NXT New Orleans is close, and I'm going to be at Takeover Brooklyn, so it'll be three takeovers this year. But that was I think. Would you put Philly ahead of New Orleans for the two?
Philly was.
All right, so here's the card. Philly had Undisputed Era, Authors of Pain, Velveteen, Cassius Ohno, Ember, Shayna, Black, Cole, and. Almas. No, you're right. New Orleans may be the better overall.
New Orleans
card.
Is better. Yeah. Because you get. Who does Dream face at Orleans?
All right. So here's a full card for New Orleans. Cole. It's got the ladder match.
Oh, the ladder. Yeah. Okay.
Shayna, Ember, Undisputed Era versus Dunn and Strong in the Authors of Pain. Black and Almas. And then Gargano, Ciampa.
Dream's not even on the card, eh? Yeah, no, that card's.
No, Velveteen's in the card. He's on the ladder match.
Oh, he's in the ladder match. That's right. Yeah, the ladder match is amazing. I mean, like, would you say Gargano Ciampa and Gargano Almas cancel each other out almost?
I liked Almas just a tick better. So, yeah, I mean, all right, I'll put him as a tie. I don't care. I mean, they're both awesome. They're both
I actually prefer Almas, the Almas match, too. But
yeah,
but that's just because, I know, there's just something different in the way those two wrestle. I really like Almas. I think Almas is exceptional. So my number four is... It's a strange one. It's from last year when two buddies and I, we drove down to Ottawa to see TNA Bound for Glory 2017.
Okay.
Look, the show is garbage. I wouldn't say garbage. It was fun. But, I mean, I think you know this about me, that if it's a small arena and I'm sitting close to the wrestlers, I will just scream at them all night and just try to, like, in character almost. And so... All night, we just yelled and screamed. And if you watch Bound for Glory 2017, you will see two things. You will hear someone yell at Alberto Del Rio that it wasn't right what they did to him when he's doing this ranting promo about how he didn't do anything about Paige and all that, and about him being the victim. And you will also see three guys who are sitting on the hard camera shot that, like, whenever anything happened, had their hands on their heads. Staring into the camera. And I can't tell you how fun and silly that entire night was, because it was just us every 2 seconds jumping up, grabbing our heads. It was running down to the barricade and screaming at Chris Masters until he laughed. Like, it was just a really fun night. The show was garbage, but I don't know. Being that close was great.
Yeah. And I, you know, I didn't even put in like any, like, I've been to some indie shows of late where I've just had a great time. Like the XWA show here, fucking Joey Bones winning the battle royal. I mean, we were like basically up against the barricade, and like that was a great time. Like some of those didn't even make this list, and I'd put those up there. Like the time we went and saw my buddy John Walters wrestle, and we were heckling him in the aisle, and like we got the video of that. Like, so I mean, I've had great memories like that too. So many. All right. So what's your number three?
My number three is. The most infamous pay-per-view of all time, Survivor Series 1997. Bret Hart getting screwed. I mean, the show, if you go watch the show now, it's fucking garbage. It's just a terrible show top to bottom. I do think the Michaels-Bret match is actually quite good. But being there live for that atmosphere was crazy. It was so cool to be – like even the Team Canada-Team USA match, the atmosphere was crazy. Like Bulldog hitting Vader with the bell and pinning him. was a huge pop. And being there at the, for the surreal end and piecing together what happened without any commentary, without anything, it was just a real surreal, bizarre night. And it had to be on my list, even though the show sucked.
All right, my number three, again, kind of like you, wasn't the most memorable of shows, but it has one moment that just like lives on for me, and that is the Monday Night Raw in Providence, July 16th, 2001. There was a week before, it was a go-home for Invasion, and it's when Austin was at the bar kind of questioning himself the whole episode, and then he comes out and just destroys the Alliance, on a, you know, just wipes them out, and it ends with him, Kane, Taker, Jericho, and Angle. All in the ring after killing the Alliance, and that's to go home, and then he turns, obviously, at Invasion. But that moment, like, the pop when he comes out and cleans house was a euphoria like you rarely see in wrestling.
Right.
And I'm just buzzing after the show, just everyone chanting Austin. Like, it was such an amazing moment. And you don't think of 01 Austin as, like, huge pops. You think of his great heel work. You think of his biggest stuff in, like, 97, 98, as far as, like, pop-wise, or 99. But, I mean, this was as big and as wild as it gets. Like, it's worth reliving it, like, on the network and stuff, just to watch that moment when he comes out. Because everyone is just going fucking bonkers. And right. It also has it had another cool moment when Tajiri saves, or it's Taz versus Regal. Tajiri interferes and rips off his shirt. And you think he's ECW, but then he actually attacks Taz and goes with Regal. It's such a heartwarming moment because they had all this stuff where he, you know, he was working for him, and you think he's going to go with the Alliance with everyone else, and then he actually, you know, he's actually with Regal in the WWF, and that was another really cool moment. And it's got a decent Booker Jericho match on there too, Angle versus Raven. Here you go, right. Dudley's Hardys. So I wonder if that's one of the matches you like.
I bet it was great.
Yeah, so you know, it's got some decent stuff, but the ending is really where it's at. Well, Austin coming out, so that was just an all time memory for me.
Awesome. Your number two
is my first WrestleMania, and that is WrestleMania 20 in MSG. Uh-huh. Obviously, you know, the memory takes a hit because of the way things ended with both Eddie and Benoit. But in the moment, like the euphoria when Benoit finally taps Triple H, like, oh, my God, they did it. And just screaming, tap, tap, tap. And then when Triple H does that fake out rollover, and you're like, oh, the whole audience just groans. Like, you're just like, oh, no. And then Benoit rolls back through and taps him, and the place just goes fucking nuts. Just such an incredible moment. And the whole night was just special, starting with when they do the opening video, and you think it's Vince passing the torch, right? Little do we know. But you think it's Vince passing it, right? It's him, Shane, and the grandson, like, in that picture. And it's kind of like, all right, where it all begins again. Like, here's a new era. And no celebrities. Benoit and Eddie were crowning the guy. Like, it really felt like a changing of a guard show. The first Hall of Fame, you got the touching stuff with Bobby. Like, I wish Monsoon was here. And, like, you know, I know it's a bloated show. There's a lot of crap on there. But overall, as a night, it was just like, it was just a really super memorable night. And the main event was awesome.
It's a great WrestleMania, too. Yeah. Like, it's in the top, at least in the top half, maybe the top third, yeah?
Yeah, I think so. I'd have to look back at where we had it when we did, like, Brad and Chad. But, yeah, I mean, I think it's in there. It's long. I mean, you could lop off – if you lopped off, like, two or three matches and tightened it, it's probably an all-time classic. But there's enough real good stuff in there to make it pop.
Yeah, take out the Undertaker Kane, even though you get Undertaker come back.
Well, I'd even leave that and make it quick. I'd take out those two tags. You could
take
out
the big, the eight mans or what, eight teams or four teams, right?
Yeah, you could take that out. You could take the evening gown match out. Like, you know, there's bloat there that you could kill. But as far as, like, if you look at the per match, you got Eddie Angle, you got the main event, you got Jericho Christian, and then you got Rock and Sock Evolution. Like, those are four fucking tremendous matches on a WrestleMania. Yeah. So.
Yeah. No. That's an awesome card. My number two is, also a show we went together, but it wasn't really about the, I was really happy to be around everybody, but it was more about discovering something new that would launch me into a whole new realm of fandom. And that was the night before the 1995 Royal Rumble, 2015 Royal Rumble, we went to see the Ring of Honor taping. And I can't tell you how much that show changed my perception on wrestling completely. Mm-hmm. Like, the main event was the Young Bucks and AJ Styles against Cedric Alexander, Matt Sydal, and who's the ACH.
Yeah.
ACH. And I think it's probably still the best match I've ever seen live. And that's and the next night we saw Brock, Cena, and Seth Rollins.
Mm-hmm.
So it just opened my eyes to as a fan of Ring of Honor, as a fan of the Young Bucks, as a fan of even AJ Styles at the time. And it's because of that night that was a great show top to finish. I really enjoyed learning about all these people. It was in the ECW Arena too, which was great. I'd never been there before. It was just such a passionate fan experience. Everybody chanting every 2 seconds. Like the Briscoes came out, everybody went crazy. And without that show, I probably wouldn't have discovered Ring of Honor. I probably wouldn't have discovered New Japan, which is more the wrestling I turn to now for quality wrestling.
Mm-hmm.
So a great show that really led me in the right direction.
Yeah. No, it was a great night. Yeah. And like you said, that 1-2 of, you know, that and then Brock Rollins and Cena, which is just amazing as well. I had that at 5 stars too. So, I mean, we saw basically 2 5-star matches in a weekend. And then you get the insane Rumble experience on top of
it.
No, it was quite the weekend. It was a great weekend. I mean, before New Orleans, it was probably my favorite. Well, it was probably – it's top three. Like, of the Place Me Nation era, my top three weekends are, you know, 29 and then Philly 15 and then New Orleans. Like, those are my three.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, it was a good weekend.
I'd say Pittsburgh, too, if I wasn't dead on a hotel room floor for most of it.
Right.
All right. What's your number one?
Okay, my number one, I mean, this is the one I kind of cheated on. I'm going to split it between two because I'm going to go with the very first house show I ever went to, which was November 28th, 1987. My dad took me, and my dad ended up taking me to – he would take me almost every time they came. We'd go to the old Montreal Forum. The first show I saw was the main event was Hulk Hogan defending against the One-Man Gang. And I don't know, it was just – as a 7-year, I was 7 at the time, and – going there and experiencing that live was just so cool. I remember a conversation I had with my dad when we were leaving the building. We were walking to the subway, and I don't know why this was important to me, but I was trying to make the point that, like, it'd be really great if the One-Man Gang was just a bunch of wrestlers packed into him. He was one man, but he was a gang. This is my 7-year-old logic. But it became a thing that me and my dad did together. I mean, for my whole childhood, and I would get excited when we got tickets. I'd go to the old, we have a store here called The Bay, and we'd buy the tickets there. And I just want to contrast that with a show I went to last year, which was a house show they did in Montreal. The main event was Sami Zayn and Kevin Owens in a street fight, which was actually awesome. But what was great about it is I went with my dad and my son, and it kind of really solidified to me what wrestling is to me now. It's something, and my dad was never a fan. That's also something that kind of struck me. My dad, for those of you, my dad also passed away this year. So getting to do that with him and do that with my son, and I knew it was something that he was never really into, but he did for me, you know. And even when he came the second time, when he came last year, I think he enjoyed it, but he enjoyed more seeing how it had changed and seeing how my son was seeing it for the first time. So those two really kind of stood out to me as something really special. And going forward, it's a really great bonding thing that I have with my son. And that's, in the end, now more than anything, why I'm a fan. And it just started with my dad.
I should have just went first. Okay. So, all right. I'll let that breathe for a minute. Yeah, I mean, I didn't even touch on some of the older ones. Obviously, some of the first ones I went to that really got me into it. And, you know, King of the Ring 97, the infamous of my buddy Jim, who his dad passed away. I think I probably
told
this.
It's not a fucking contest. It's not a contest, all right?
No, I know. I'm out. No, but it's it's one of my favorite memories. So he picks us up, and he had been watching King of the Ring 97 on TV. He picks us up after the show, and he's like, he gets to the car. And he's all excited. He's all fired. You know, how he used to call him the bouts. How are the bouts? How are the bouts? We're like, oh, yeah, it was really good. You know, thanks for picking us up. And he's like, oh. He's like, they said Mankind's real name on the broadcast. And he's like all excited to break the news for us, right? He's like, you know, it's cute, right? I mean, we know, obviously, but he's all pumped up. He's like, it was Monty. Now we're like, no, it's Mick. Yeah, Mick. Mickey Walsh. Mickey Walsh was his name. We're like, oh, God. But it always stuck with me, the Monty Walsh, Monty Mickey Walsh thing. It was a fun memory because of just, like, not being able to have to drive to the show and getting picked up and, like, yeah. You know, like that part of it and just the innocence in his dad's voice when he was breaking this news to us that he thought was, like, the biggest story ever. You know, we didn't have the heart to say it that, no, we know. Everyone knows. they've been talking about his real name for months on TV now. Anyway, so my number one, I'm not going to go too deep into it. I've talked and written about it ad nauseum, and that's the 12/29/98 Raw taping, the 1/4/99 Raw, where Mick Foley defeats The Rock for the title. I mean, nothing will ever touch it. The whole story, driving the limo up there, the snowstorm, you know, getting the tickets because I went to the WCW house show, that Goldberg no show, so they gave us a refund. I had that money, went and bought the Raw tickets with it. And then Foley just, you know, you're not expecting a world title change on a tape show like that. So Foley, you know, the pop when Austin comes out and Foley wins is a second to none. Just the euphoria, high-five and hugging random people in the crowd. I'd never seen a title change live. Like, there's just so much about it that meant so much. The through line throughout the whole episode just builds and builds and builds. It's really an immaculate, you know, snapshot of an Attitude Era Raw. There's some bad in there, too. I think it's the one where Terry falls off and has the miscarriage. You know, so there's some bad in it, but there's also some you know, it's the perfect, like, dichotomy of a Russo Raw. Like, there's so much good and so much bad and just balled up into one. Right. But I'll never forget it. Like, just our seats were incredible. The whole night was incredible.
Cool. That would have been a great night to be there.
Yeah, it was. And I wrote about it. You can read more about the whole story on PlayStation.com. A Long December is the title of the piece. So.
Cool.
All right.
I feel like we got to the end and we didn't call. Nobody called someone a jockass. So.
Well, we're not done yet.
okay, good.
So real quick, our post-match celebration here. What is a recent moment of joy you've had, real quick?
Well, I've been playing this board game called Thanos Rising, which is a collaborative board game where you play as basically like superheroes fighting Thanos from the Avengers Infinity War movie. Mm-hmm. And today, my wife and I played three games, and the first gets collaborative. So the first two games, he just fucking wiped us out, which is annoying because we've been beating it lately. And so we played around supper time today and we beat him and it felt good. It felt good to fucking grind his ass into the ground.
There you go. That's a great moment. For me, it was yesterday, great 4th of July. Our buddy D'Amato came in and went down to the beach house owned by a Cowboy Senior. Some of you may know he's been having some health issues of late. So it was good to see him and hang out. It was just a really, really perfect day weather-wise. Spent a lot of time in the water. There's some great waves. Took my daughter out there. We were jumping the waves, and she was riding her boogie board. And it was just like, it's like a really solid day. So it was happy. I was happy to be able to sit there, have the, you know, baseball games on the radio and just chilling and just everyone having a good time with very little drama. So it was a cool day.
Yeah, that sounds great.
It was.
I took my kid. I mean, I figured like I needed a contrast to the sad father story.
Right. That was a good one.
So.
All right. That'll do it for episode two. I hope you had it.
Jockass.
Hope you had a great time. I did. We'll be back with episode three at some point in the future. Check out PlayStation.com each and every day. Plenty of written material going up. We mentioned a few things already. We had some 4th of July stuff, too. We had a video playlist of all Americana jingoism. I will be having my Nathan's Hot Dog Eating Contest piece coming up in the next few days as well. I have to keep that tradition going. What else? Subscribe to all our feeds, PlayStation Wrestling, PlayStation Pop, and Pro Wrestling Only. PlayStation.com/Amazon too. So that's all I'm going to do for tonight because I'm tired. You're tired. We're out. We'll talk to you soon.
Jockass!
Yeah! Dookie! Bye! To get naughty, get my rocks on. Eat popcorn, watch you move your body to the pop song that I'm singing. Ding-a-ringing, funky beats ringing. Everybody swinging in the place as I kick the J-A-Z-Z-Y style. R&B, mixing it with the hip-hop swing beat. Champagne in my hand, it won't be long till I'm gone. It's just the same old song. It's just the freestyle. Meanwhile, we'll keep the beat kicking. Sweat dripping. Girlies in the limo eating chicken. Oops, don't get the grease on your pantyhose. I love you, Rover. Move over. I gotta blow my nose. Sneezing, but still I'm pleasing all the slimmies. Pull out my Jimmy. Time to get busy with a Jenny. If it's good and plenty, don't you know? There I go, there I go, there I go. But